This is Dr. Laura Calkins of the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, continuing the oral history interview with Dr. Thomas Shepherd. Today is the 17th of November, 2005. As usual, I am in Lubbock, and Dr. Shepherd is speaking by telephone from Washington State. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Tom, did you want to pick up the story from our last session? We were describing your assignment in Saigon and the very interesting developments and people that you met.
Yes, that would be a good place to pick it up, Laura.
Sure.
Let me do a little background first by letting our listener or listeners know that my doctorate is in, actually, it's a business administration doctorate. But my fields of interest, the tracks that I had to study, along with management and marketing, was psychology.
Mm-hmm.
And the area that I spent most of my time in and all of my writing in is called organizational behavior. And that is the study of individuals within organizations at various levels, right up to the large overall. And so I'm speaking about people now with that doctoral background, and I just wanted the listeners to know this isn't shoot from the hip or off the top of my head.
Very good.
Sort of thing.
Very good.
One of the dictums that I've always believed is that human nature has not changed throughout recorded history. A quick example, if I may. Let's start with the Roman army.
Okay.
Marius formed the first regular Roman army. Prior to Marius' time, they were just the landed gentry who were allowed to fight in the army. Marius said, no, we've got to make this a broader-based army, and so he brought in the plebs, or plebs, as some people prefer to call them, and they became the first regular army. During that time, the Roman Senate said, if you fight for us and serve us faithfully, when you retire, we will give you land. When the soldiers came to retire, the Senate said, we changed our mind. We're not going to do that for you.
Mm-hmm.
The Continental Congress told George Washington's army, if you fight for us and you're with us for the entire war, which turned out to be 6 or 7 or 8 years, when you retire, you will get half pay for 10 years. When the war was over, the Continental Congress said, we don't think we really want to do that at all. In World War I, the Congress said, we will pay you a bonus, veterans, on a particular date. When the day came, the Congress said, we don't want to do that right now. And, of course, then they had the bonus march, and General MacArthur was told to chase the veterans out and so forth. World War II, the Congress said, if you join and fight with us for 20 years at the end of that time, we will give you health care for the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm.
And when the time came, the Congress said, we really didn't mean that. And we're going through this debacle right now of, well, if you signed up before 1957, they meant it. But if you signed up after 1957, they didn't mean it, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
The point of this is to say, human nature hasn't changed. If you look at the people in power, they're doing the same things today that they did for Marius in the Roman Empire. So, that out of the way, let's talk about arriving in Saigon. I got there in late July 1965, and General Jomo Christian, who was the J-2, had gotten there the same month, but about 3 weeks earlier, 2.5 weeks earlier. And I remember him talking about he relieved a Marine officer, and he, Jomo Christian, found that the J-2 really wasn't doing a very good job. It seemed that the J-2 under the Marine considered itself advisory, and under McChristian, he had been given directions that they would be active. They would take over the J-2 role. And supposedly, when he asked the Marine officer, what is the enemy order of battle, the Marine said, what's an order of battle? So Joe McChristian found himself starting from not scratch, but in a hole. And he always said that he had to do this very, very fast. So, under those conditions, things were very lumpy when I arrived. McChristian said that he was going to begin categorizing the enemy as maneuver units, and we would track those as one category. And there would be combat support elements that we would track as another category. And there would be administrative elements of the enemy that we would track as another category. And then he determined that we would call another category irregulars, and we would track those separately. And then we would track political operatives, and we would track those separately. And the VC, or the Viet Cong, fit two of those categories quite easily. We had Viet Cong maneuver units, and we also had Viet Cong irregulars. Generally, the administrative and combat support and political were thought to have a firm foundation of the North Vietnamese regulars within them. So those are the categories we were going to try and track. And as you might imagine, it was easier to track maneuver and combat support and admin than it was to track a category called irregulars and politicals.
Mm-hmm.
So the numbers that we began sending back when I arrived generally called for maneuver, combat support, and admin. This was at the same time that the Secretary of Defense, Robert Strange McNamara, he arrived over there in July for a meeting. It was just after I arrived. It was only a few days after I arrived. And he came over to find out personally what was going on. And you remember I had said earlier that his forte was systems analysis or
Absolutely.
Operations research. He was a matrician. If you could get numbers attached to it and you could make variables and independent variables, why, then you could understand what was going on. That was his whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of where this idea of body count came out. If you can count the numbers of dead bodies, then you have a good idea of how many of the enemy you are attriting each time. And when you juxtapose that with the number of people we're losing, then you get a scorecard, sort of like golf or something like that. And over the time that I was there, this idea of body count became a monster. That was a driving force behind an awful lot of things that went on. What is the body count? And as humans will tend to do, they found ways to boost the body count in their areas to make themselves look better than other people in other areas. And so it became one of those kinds of games.
Now, Tom, can I ask you a couple
yeah.
of questions? Relative directly to the body count idea is, of course, the sense that there's some stable or knowable manpower pool, and that being drawn down would signify increasing weakness, presumably, on the part of the enemy. But the distinction that you've made in the different groups that J2 was trying to track, of course, illuminates part of the problem, which is that not all of the combatants or people that you were tracking were from the South. Would it be fair to conclude that the groups that you described as having more association with the North Vietnamese Army or being more closely aligned with its ideas are the units that received more NVA fillers, if you want, in the South? Is that fair?
Yes.
Okay. So the combat support units, the administrative units.
Right. The maneuver units, of course, got first call.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, when specialists were needed in the support area, they were provided. And in the administrative area, they were provided. And they were provided by that famous trail coming down from the north mm-hmm. that we knew all about. Let's say all about it in the sense that we knew it existed. We knew pretty much where it went from one country to another country.
Right.
And that's where SOG came in.
Mm-hmm.
The Special Operations Group, which was run by the Army,
And you mentioned last time General Blackburn.
Right. General Blackburn was one of the first SOG commanders.
Mm-hmm.
And they would put teams into Cambodia. They would put teams in Laos trying to monitor the Ho Chi Minh Trail. They wanted to know what was coming down, when it was coming down, how it was coming down, and we would send teams in, generally three South Vietnamese, two Americans, one the team leader and the other the assistant team leader, and they would go in on these black missions and spend anywhere from 48 hours to 72 hours,
mm-hmm.
sometimes longer,
mm-hmm.
Trying to count vehicles, trying to determine the most heavily used trails and things of that nature. And, of course, one of the big problems was we weren't supposed to be in there, and so these had to be black operations, and we had to keep them more secret from the American press than we did from the North Vietnamese, because it would be more dangerous if the American press found out than if the North Vietnamese found out. And that's the way we were trying to track what was coming in.
Okay. And it was it the thought in J2 that the NVA fillers were going most likely to the maneuver units, to the combat support and administration, the political operatives, those kinds of people would be groups would be the first to receive NVA fillers?
Right, certainly. Mm-hmm. Certainly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Were you really essentially starting in a hole with regard to the order of battle?
General McChrystian felt that we were.
Wow.
Because there was, according to General McChrystian, very little order of battle, since the officer in charge of
mm-hmm.
the intelligence on the staff did not understand what order of battle really was. I think if you will look into McChrystian's testimony later on, you will find that he says essentially that very same thing.
Wow. Well, that's amazing.
It's hard to say whether we should go chronologically. Let me do General McChrystian right up to the end in
sure.
one fell swoop.
That's fine.
General McChrystian stayed over there. I left after a year, and he left after 2 years. I think he was very, very professional. He didn't consider himself an intelligence officer per se. He always thought of himself as an Army officer, and infantry is one of the keys to being a promoted Army officer.
Mm-hmm.
And so he saw himself actually as a broad-based Army officer who happened to know a great deal about intelligence. And having been kept there for 2 years in the J2 role, from what I heard, he was asked to stay on, but realized that that would be sort of a career killer, and he had to get back to the real regular Army of America.
Mm-hmm.
And so although Westy wanted him to stay on, I think he felt that it was necessary to move on for his career. If you remember when CBS and General Westmoreland were having their fracas,
mm-hmm.
And so on, McChrystian indicated in his testimony back then that before he left, he wanted Westmoreland to know that he had gotten a much better handle on those two sort of amorphous categories, irregulars and politicos, and that the numbers that he had were quite startling in terms of the size of them. And he indicated that Westmoreland would not let him send those figures to Washington, and indicated that they would stay with Westmoreland and he would decide when those figures would go.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you stick a couple of thousand onto the numbers that you've been reporting for the last 24 months, and suddenly they jump up when you've been talking about the end of the light of the light at the end of the tunnel,
mm-hmm.
and the fact that you're treating the enemy at a good clip, killing them so many to one, and so on, to show Congress that whoops, that number has now jumped way up. Would be embarrassing, so to speak. So McChristian left feeling that that information had not been forwarded while he was there. And he came to the States and got an armored division. It was hell on wheels. He was the second armored division division commander, and that was down in Texas. And he was down there for a while. And now by this time, I'm back in the States, and I'm working with a joint and combined staff called the Atlantic Command. And the Atlantic Command is in Norfolk. We have a four-star Navy admiral running it, and I'm one of the few Army officers on the staff, and I'm charged with, I'm the head of intelligence collection for the J-2
mm-hmm.
for the command. And after I had been there 3 years, I thought, well, now I'm going back to the Army, and suddenly I got a set of orders to JCS, and I was going to be then with the Joint Chiefs of Staff, special staff called the Joint Strategic Target Planning Staff, where we would do all of the nuclear planning against the Soviet Union, and we would produce the PSYOP, the Single Integrated Operations Plan, which combined all of the forces that could deliver nuclear weapons on the Soviet Union, and that, of course, would be the Navy and the Army. And they were having a little internecine warfare between the Navy and the Army,
mm-hmm.
and the JSTPS was a joint staff. It had the SAC commander, that's the Strategic Air Command commander, mm-hmm. the general, four-star Air Force general. His deputy was a three-star Navy admiral. And in 1969, that was Admiral Noel Geiler, a well-known, well-liked Navy admiral. When it came time for me to be reassigned, and I was hoping to go back to the Army since I had been away from it now for 3.5 years, roughly.
All right.
I suddenly got orders to the JCS, to the Joint Strategic Target Planning Staff, and that was in Offutt Air Force Base, which is right next door to Omaha, Nebraska. And that was another reason I didn't want to go there. And looking about for help, I found that my General Joe McChristian was now the Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence under General Westmoreland, who had become the Chief of Staff of the United States Army. And so thinking, well, Joe McChristian knows me, he knows my work, maybe if I appeal to him personally,
mm-hmm.
he could ensure that I got back to the Army. So I went to the Pentagon, and I had an appointment with General McChristian, and it was early in the morning, like 9 o'clock. And I went in to see him. I reported. He, of course, remembered me. We chatted for a few moments, and I told him of my dilemma of wanting to get back to the Army, which he could understand. He told me not to worry. He would take care of it. Come back at 3 in the afternoon, and he would have a change of orders for me.
Wow.
At 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I came back, and the mood had changed considerably. Now, a very grumpy, disgruntled Major General McChristian called me in and said very shortly, there's nothing I can do about it. There's nothing I can do. Noel Geiler wants you, and he's going to get you. So you're going to go to SAC headquarters. Just, I can't help you. Yes, sir. So I found out later
mm-hmm.
that Geiler wanted an intermediary. See, the slot I was going to have was JLED, Joint List Estimates Division. I was going to be responsible for all of the air defense information in terms of targeting that went to both the Air Force and the Navy so we could iron out who was going to get which target. And I found out as I got there and got deeper into the problem that Giler felt the Army officer there would be most helpful if he knew very well what Navy officers did and were like. And he had checked down into the Atlantic Command with the four-star down there.
Mm-hmm.
And guess what? They found an Army officer who at one time had sailed across on an aircraft carrier, who had been a midshipman USNR when he was in college, and all of those things that made me seem to Giler to be the perfect guy to interject between the two services, because he knew my impartiality would be biased perhaps a little bit toward the Navy.
And the objective for him was to get the most select target for the Navy.
To have as big a piece of turf in the targeting in the battle as the Navy could get. Remember that the Navy was using submarines, and they had aircraft that could be launched from aircraft carriers. The smallest one was the A-4, and all manners of things, whereas the Air Force had the ballistic missile force and all of the B-52s. And they had just gotten rid of another B-57 that could deliver and so on. So the Air Force felt it was really their territory. They envisioned the Navy as doing things at sea.
Sure.
And Giler envisioned the Navy as being a full participant since they could deliver nukes in many areas and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that was the lever that got me to spend my time with the Navy for another 4 years.
In beautiful Nebraska.
In beautiful Omaha, Nebraska. Now, in the meantime, McChristian is the Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence.
Right.
And in the late 60s, the anti-war crowd had gotten very, very strong and very loud. And they began talking about such things as kidnapping Henry Kissinger and holding him prisoner until we got out of Vietnam. They blew up a lab on a university campus and killed somebody. They had a townhouse in New York blown to pieces as they were making a homemade bomb. So this became what we perceived to be a very real threat internally. And Congress and others in the Department of Defense began to think that the Army, which in its intelligence corps had a number of, quote, agents, unquote, the Army should play a greater role since the FBI had a finite number of people.
Mm-hmm.
The CIA was not allowed to do that sort of stuff in the United States.
Right.
They were to operate overseas. But the Army intelligence had these young trained officers and enlisted men. Couldn't they be used? And it was decided they could. And Joe McChristian was tasked with setting up the program that would try and infiltrate and follow and check out all of these war protesters, since the FBI didn't have enough people to do it.
Right.
So he did, and so we did. And so the Army became heavily involved in tracking the anti-war movement. Well, suddenly the conditions changed, and Congress decided that it was totally un-American to have American citizens being followed around by these people, the Army intelligence agents. agents, and that was a horrendous crime and shouldn't be tolerated. And Senator Church started a big investigation in which she excoriated all of the intelligence agencies, and they had pictures of Church with a pistol with a silencer, and he was shouting, "This is an assassination weapon," and so forth and so on. Well, a head had to roll. Somebody had to pay for that. And guess who the axie was? It was Joe McChristian. His boss was General Westmoreland. Now, all I can say that I know about it is suddenly Joe McChristian, who had 2 stars, mm-hmm. whose father-in-law had 4, who was a West Pointer, who considered himself to be the ultimate professional soldier, suddenly found himself with the rug pulled out from under him, pointed at as doing bad things and un-American things, and he had to go. And General Westmoreland didn't step in and say, "Wait a minute, the buck stops here. I'm the chief of staff. I'm the one who is most responsible for the Army." That didn't happen. And so suddenly Joe McChristian retired. Just, bing, gone. And I know that really was a blow. He retired in 1971 as a major general.
And, Tom, in your view, certainly Westmoreland was aware of all of this.
Absolutely.
In fact, I think it's been suggested he was one of the driving forces in expanding the role of U.S. military intelligence inside the United States. Ought he have done something different?
Well, I could. It's not my place to say, "Well, what do you think?" But that would be a good question to any researcher. What do you think?
Mm-hmm.
Where does the buck stop? Mm-hmm. When does someone step up and say, "Hey, I'm responsible for this, and it happened on my watch"? But that didn't happen. I don't know why it didn't happen, but it didn't happen. And Joe McChristian retired in 1971 as a major general. And to cap it off, mm-hmm. Willie DePew, General Willie DePew, went on to a 3rd star and a 4th star. And I think that rankled a little. You know, general officers in the Army get written reports all of the time they're retired. If you're a brigadier general and 4-star general, you get a special report from the Department of the Army every so often. It's sort of an insider's view of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I am quite sure that Joe McChristian looked at that every time, and when he would see that TRADOC's General William DePew says this or that, I'm sure that rankled like mad. And so that's sort of the way this career ended for General McChristian.
Tom, did you ever have a chance to speak with him after this?
No.
Did you ever speak?
The last time I contacted him, was when I asked him to help me get back to the Army,
right.
And that would have been 69. He retired in 71, and I had no contact with him from 69 through 71.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you don't have any notion what had happened during the course of the day when you saw him a couple times, to take him from your best bud who was about to make something happen to...
Yeah, I think what I surmised,
mm-hmm.
that he went in thinking, well, here's a simple matter, a little favor I can do for one of my subordinates.
Right.
And I think he got slapped in the face with, "No, you can't do that because they have a higher call than you do." And I think he found, once again, he was sort of on shaky ground.
He was hitting a brick wall.
Yeah. He didn't have the clout,
yeah.
that he thought he should have as a axie, as the major general. I'm sure he thought he could take an Army intelligence. At that time, I was a light colonel.
Right.
I'm sure he felt, well, I can assign him over here. That's what generals do, and I'm the head of intelligence. And he was told, that's not what you're going to do. He's going over here. The Navy wants him, blah, blah, blah.
Right, some admiral who nobody owed anything to, presumably.
Some three-star admiral.
Right.
And I think it was just another example of, well, back in the Vietnam days, I told Westy, here's the figures. I'm going to send them forward. He told me, no, you're not. Here I am saying, hey, I'm the head of Axie, and I'm going to move one of my guys over here. And he's told, no, you're not. And then, of course, it's capped off by, we told you to put these intelligence agents out. Now, that's a bad thing to do. You're going to pay the price.
Yeah.
And that was that.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting character development on Westmoreland, that's for sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it decries the Boy Scout image that he has, and the fact that that may be what happened. I still think of him as a terrific guy, and I have the highest opinion of him because I really don't know what did happen. Let's say a word about Lyndon Baines Johnson.
Sure. Why not?
We'll throw him in too.
Sure. One of my favorite characters. Go ahead.
In organizational behavior, one of the phenomena we discuss, and there's been a pretty good amount of research on it, is this thing called the imposter syndrome. And that is where a person finds himself in a position that he or she feels they are totally unprepared for,
mm-hmm.
but they're in the position and they have to put on the face and go forward if they can, but inwardly they're telling themselves, I'm an imposter. I don't belong here. What am I doing here? Supposing they find out who I am. Here's an example. Jodie Foster, the movie star that most people would know today,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
very important movie star, and she rarely gives interviews, but I had an interview of her on tape that I used to use in class occasionally, and Jodie Foster is a graduate of Yale University, I believe.
I think so. Mm-hmm.
And she has won two Academy Awards, one when she was like 12 years old or 13 years old. She was telling the interviewer that every once in a while when she wakes up, just for a moment, she's afraid she'll hear a knock on the door. And when she answers the door, they will be standing there, and they will tell her, give us back that diploma from Yale. Give us those Oscars. Who do you think you are? You're just Jodie Foster. That's sort of the imposter syndrome.
And is part of it, Tom, am I accurate in saying this, that there's the fear that you don't, not only that they'll be found, that you'll be found out, but that you don't deserve.
You don't deserve it, and you can't do it.
You can't. Yes, you're not up to it.
Right. Billy uh-huh. Joel has said in interviews, when he's behind the curtain in one of those outdoor arenas where there are 15,000 screaming fans hollering, Billy, 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 and he says to himself, God, what if they find out I'm just a kid from Long Island that lived next to a potato farm, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then he steps out, and they all go wild. He has to become, if he can, Billy Joel.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mention that simply because Lyndon Baines Johnson, one of his biographers, not Robert Caro, woman.
Doris Kearns Goodwin?
Doris Kearns Goodwin.
Mm-hmm.
In one of her meetings with LBJ, indicated that he always felt, what if they find out that I'm just a guy who comes from, it's not Shallow Dish, Texas, but it's, what if they find out who I am? I'm supposed to be the leader of the Senate, and I'm mm-hmm. supposed to be the most powerful man, but suppose find out that I'm, oh, supposing they find out I'm from Stonewall, Texas, and then what will they do? And he indicated to her that when he was suddenly thrust into the presidency, that that plagued him all of the time, that they would find out he was just Lyndon Johnson from Stonewall, Texas. Who the hell did he think he was sitting in the president's desk or on it or behind it, kind of a thing.
Very interesting.
And I think that that insecurity had a lot to do with his seeming constant meddling or trying to have complete control over what was going on in Vietnam. I think that's one of the reasons he could not turn the war over to his generals and say, here's the objective, get it done. That's why he was calling that officer in the COC that afternoon or evening when I walked in there.
Yes.
And so my feeling is that Johnson is one of the great architects, along with the input from Robert Strange McNamara, of our failure in Vietnam. The imposter syndrome. He kept wondering, what the hell am I doing here? And looking back, I wonder what he was doing there, too. So,
just to clarify, you sourced that mistake in his operational activities, his reaching way down out of chain of command to try to find out what was happening in a particular village.
Yeah,
or
up in I-Corps. He wanted to know what was going on in
I-Corps. And you source all of that. Now, this is you speaking as a organizational behavior.
I sourced behaviorist. That by witnessing the phone, the other end of the phone call.
Yeah.
That's how I know that happened.
Sure.
And at that particular moment, what was going on in I-Corps was sort of an insurrection. The South Vietnamese general up there felt he was being put upon and his turf wasn't being well respected by the others in the government, and he was going to raise hell. He was going to take charge, break away, and they were ringing his enclave with troops loyal to them, and the troops in the enclave were loyal to him, and we were wondering, are we going to have a civil war up in I-Corps between our own guys? So that was quite a moment to see how that was going to turn out. And Johnson was calling down to find out how it was going to turn out too. And
your sense is that that arose from his insecurity.
Yes.
As a leader.
As a leader.
As
right.
a statesman.
I'm sorry.
As a statesman as well. Not just a leader of an organization.
I never applied that word to Johnson.
Okay. I think that's fair.
He's a politician. Mm-hmm. Statesman, I don't think, has ever entered into the picture.
Okay. Would he, this is just theoretical and bouncing back and forth in your opinion if you want to offer it. Would Johnson have done better had he stayed off the ticket with John Kennedy and stayed in the Senate and run that for the next 30 years or whatever?
Boy, that's quite a question. It really is.
I know, and historians like me tend to hate these kind of questions, although they are entertaining.
But if you follow the ignominious treatment that he had when he went from the most powerful man in the Senate to the job that wasn't worth a warm bucket of spit, as someone once said, the vice presidency, he was overlooked and uncared for, and he was wallowing around down there, and I'm sure he was as frustrated as a politician could be, and he was probably thinking, is this the way it's going to end? And then suddenly he's thrust into the presidency.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, wow, what a change.
Yeah, yeah, from nowhere man to number one.
And I could see the imposter syndrome really hitting him hard when he suddenly found himself sitting in the Oval Office and saying to himself, what if they find out it's me, you know, the consummate politician.
Interesting.
So those are some of the players that I felt I knew something about
mm-hmm.
during that particular time.
Tom, let me run another name past you. I think it's one that you mentioned earlier, but we didn't have time to go into. In listing a number of interesting people who came to your briefings,
mm-hmm.
you, I think, mentioned Senator Kennedy. That would be Ted Kennedy.
That would be Ted Kennedy.
And I wonder if he's one of the people that you have a view on that you'd care to share. First of all, before offering your view, maybe you can say a little bit about his appearance in Saigon and what he was up to.
Okay.
If you have any idea.
Most of the people who came to Saigon let's put it this way. Mm-hmm. Most of the people that I briefed from our government came to Saigon because it was the thing to do and the place to be seen.
It's where it was happening.
Where it was happening. Mm-hmm. It showed your deep interest. It gave you an opportunity to be able to say later on, well, when I was speaking to Westy 3 weeks ago in Saigon, things of that nature. And so I did. I had a number of senators. I had a larger number of congressmen. I had some industrialists. And I will admit to you
mm-hmm.
that we had a guy who was going to become president pretty soon. But no one believed it. We thought Richard Nixon was done when he said, I'm not going to be here to kick around anymore. I thought he was over. So he came through for a briefing, and it was being paid for by the Pepsi-Cola company, and I assigned one of my junior briefers to take that briefing. I didn't have the time to prepare one for him.
No kidding.
And I look back now and think, gee, I could have said I briefed a president of the United States. But that was my, at the time, the workload must have been quite heavy or something. And
well, and he was pretty far out of the loop.
And he seemed to be out of it
yeah.
in terms of being a successful politico again. And he was being sponsored by Pepsi-Cola Company.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so I gave that to one of my captain briefers and said, you take this one,
I will
be unavailable.
It's really interesting because it does index something that I think people lose track of, which is, how off the radar he was after losing
yes.
the California gubernatorial election and just kind of faded out.
He bounced back, though, didn't he?
Oh, in a big way. It's really one of the most remarkable stories, I think, of American
exactly.
American politics in the 20th century.
Exactly.
He's a really interesting guy. But so you handed that one off.
Yes, I handed that one off. Now, here's what we found. Because of jet lag,
mm-hmm.
you remember the going in the other direction and coming over there, I found that many of the senators, if they were whisked directly into MACV for a briefing, I found that they could not help themselves, and they would start to nod off in the briefing, and consequently,
mm-hmm.
You had to keep it lively. I did a lot of moving around and
like a floor show almost.
Almost right. You had to give a performance,
right.
not a briefing,
yeah.
in order to be able to keep them awake. And I felt for them. I know what jet lag is like and all of that. But sometimes, particularly some of the older senators, they would just kind of nod off. So I always thought it was best if they spent some time down at Just Pal. For the first day, and then got out to MACV later on.
Mm-hmm.
One of the guys I briefed, for instance, was Arnaud de Borchgraaf.
I think you told...
Does that ring a bell?
Was he Newsweek or, I can't remember, an editor, yes?
No. De Borchgraaf has become editor of a couple of different things, but
okay.
at this time, he was a correspondent.
Okay.
He was I think they would call him a senior editor for Newsweek.
Mm-hmm.
But really, the editor title just really means you're contributing. contributing and you travel for them, and it's a nice title rather than a writer. So Dvorsakov came, and I always thought of him as a very good guy, a shrewd guy, one of the few reporters that I ran across that I thought was pretty much on our side. I gave him his first official intelligence briefing when he came in country. And a few weeks later, I found much of my briefing in Newsweek under the byline of Arno Dvorsakov. He had used, remember, we sanitized, so we weren't giving things away per se, but he presented it in a pretty straightforward fashion. There wasn't that twist, that snideness that said, well, if you really believe this kind of stuff, that wasn't there. So I thought Dvorsakov did a good job. I think the person you remember me mentioning was Kyes Beach, who was a newspaper reporter. He worked, I believe, out of Chicago. He won a Pulitzer Prize. He had flirted with communism when he was a youth. And he was a friend of my CIA contract agent friend. That's how I met him. And he was the one who could look at me, smile, and derive intelligence information from it, because he was so shrewd or something like that.
A great swami of some kind.
Yeah, he was indeed the swami. We had industrialists. I mentioned Tex Thornton come through.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
We had politicians from other countries.
And you mentioned Edward Heath last time.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Edward Heath came through, and then eventually he made the prime minister. I've got a schedule. I'm flipping through a notebook I've got, and I've got a schedule here. We'll just see what this says.
Okay.
March 23rd, 24th, 1966. Schedule of briefing for senior officers. They started at 9:30 at the American Embassy, and they were spoken to by the mission coordinator named Wilson. Then they were welcomed by Ambassador Lodge. Then they had an outline of the mission and its elements, the mission's mission and its elements, by Deputy Ambassador Porter. Then they had a political briefing by a chap named Habib, who was the counselor of political affairs. Then they were whisked over to MacVie, where General Westmoreland met them and introduced Major Shepard. And I had them for approximately a half hour discussing the enemy situation and the area of operations. Mm-hmm. And that was a typical kind of an arrangement. When someone was extra special, one time we had a chap named Gardner, who was the Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, which, as you know, has now been abolished and has a different name. But Secretary Gardner came over, and I remember specifically Westy telling me that he wanted me to give the briefing without notes. Now, he rarely made any kind of a statement like that, but he wanted me to stand up and do the briefing as if, how shall I say, this was, I was so imbued with the data that I didn't have to look down at a note.
It just flowed forth.
Yes, and I don't know why, but indeed that's the way I did it, and I did it, we used to say, hearse, and rehearse. And that meant I gave that 30-minute briefing probably 10 times before the secretary ever showed his face in the office, and that's the way we worked it.
Now, on this kind of typical outline visit, would your performance be the only part of it that you would be involved in, or would you accompany them?
I would then sit on the side of the briefing theater, so that when we got the Q&A, if they had some specific thing, that was in the intelligence area, and Joe McChristian did not attend, and many times he did not attend, then the question would be thrown to me, and I would answer it based on our position. And if we didn't have a position, I would say we don't have a position, and I would try not to answer it, because having once offered my personal opinion at the insistence of the briefee, when I gave my opinion that, you remember when Willie DePue jumped up and hollered horseshit and embarrassed me, and I think himself, although he didn't realize it at the time, and jumped into what he thought things should be. So that's the way the briefings generally went. We also had an almost every other day briefing for junior officers who arrived in country, just to kind of get them up to speed so they would hear the terminology and have a broader picture of the whole operation, so that when they went to their small unit in one particular province or so on, they would have an understanding of what was going on around them.
So this would be something like a 360 review of current operations, something like that?
Although we didn't use those terms of 360 reviews in those days, we would call it, say, a sit rep, a situation report. So we could say, this is what you're going to be faced with, and this is what you're doing.
And would these be G2 officers that you would
No, these would be officers who were going to units. Some would be going to advisory units with the rough puff, and some would be going to divisions and so on.
Was there a threshold in rank usually for attending these briefings as a new
person?
Well,
I can remember meeting my former roommate from the advanced course in the briefing, and I was a major at the time. So he was a major at the time, so I would say it was field grade.
Okay. And you did these more or less every other day?
Yeah.
Wow. How many people were you likely to have?
Oh, just 15 or 16, 17, something like that.
Wow, that still talks a lot about the traffic into the country in this early part of the buildup.
I was once sent down to the airport, Tansanute, to meet a Marine major, because no one wanted to do that, because the Marine major had been pulled out of his assignment in some Marine base with something like 48 hours notice to get over here, and as he was en route, they discovered that they really didn't need him and want him. Anyhow, so I was given the task of meeting him and sort of holding his hand while it was explained that all of that fuss and feathers, all of the rush, all of the do it, hurry up was absolutely unnecessary, and we would be looking for a place for him. Since he was already here, we weren't going to send him back. He would stay on for a tour. So there were some mistakes being made early on, too. One of the fellows I mentioned, I went to the Cirque Sportif every day.
Yes.
One of the chaps I went with was a lieutenant colonel called Dave Toomey. He was the admin, how will I put it? He was the administrator of the J2 section. He was a light colonel. He was a Marine. He had a master's degree, and I really used to pull his chain, because we were still operating on, what do you need a master's degree for in the Marine Corps, Dave? And we would do that a lot to him. And Dave ended up as Lieutenant General to me. He retired in California shortly after. Oh, let's see, 1980, I think. And I've been in touch with him once or twice since then, but I always got a kick out of. He was a wonderful Marine and the model of what a Marine officer should be, and he took a lot of leg pulling about, you know, why do you have to get a master's degree to be in the Marine Corps and things, but he ended up with 3 stars, so that was pretty good.
Yeah, it stood him in good stead as he went forward.
Did he what?
As he went forward, that stood him in good stead.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Sure. And, you know, it became the norm. Very shortly thereafter, I met other Marines who had garnered a master's degree, and just like the other services, pretty soon, if you didn't have a master's, why, you weren't going to be on the fast track. That's why I got 2.
Right. Well, absolutely. Why not? Also,
sure.
This is the other
sure.
part. In terms of VIPs, you did mention Dr. Kissinger's arrival,
right.
And I just wonder, out of curiosity, did any of the senators that you met with make a particular impression on you, either Kennedy or some of the others who might have been responsible for armed services work
or
foreign affairs?
Okay, here's one. He was from Ohio. He was an older gentleman, and I can't remember his name. But he came to my briefing and slept through the entire thing. I tap danced, I rapped on the board, I changed the tone and tenor of my voice.
Mm-hmm.
He slept through the entire thing. And the next day, he gave a briefing to the press in which he totally denigrated the American effort in Vietnam.
Leading you to conclude?
That he came over there mm-hmm. in order to give this speech to the press. He didn't hear a thing that was said to him, and he didn't care either. He had a point of view. He was an anti-war guy. Maybe that's what he needed to be elected,
mm-hmm.
and that was the pronouncement that he made. I can't remember his name. Young sticks in my mind, but that may not be it. But if you look in the records and see
sure.
who was the senator
sure.
in 1965-66, Ohio, that sucker just slept through the whole thing and then gave a briefing to the press, which was just absolutely adversarial to the American position in Vietnam.
What about the press itself? Earlier you mentioned that they were sort of tagged by some of the guys at McVee as the Caravelle Commandos, and I think that's right.
Right.
Were there any other members of the press that you thought were doing good work over there?
Let me rack my brain.
Okay, not so much, huh?
Yeah, I've mentioned Arno de Borchgrave.
Mm-hmm.
For a while, I thought Ward Just was doing okay. And one chap that I really thought was doing okay was named Kahn, and he is now the president of the Wall Street Journal. I thought his reporting was accurate and true and unbiased. And I can't remember his full name now, but he is the president and CEO of the Wall Street Journal, which I think is wonderful.
How much of a problem was the press, members of the press who were over there who are not on this list?
Okay. Well, they were a great problem.
Mm-hmm.
Totally a great problem. Everything we said, you remember I mentioned that Westmoreland, in a briefing to his senior officers, had to make the statement that while we had this new kind of napalm,
right.
That, my God, we shouldn't mention that to anyone. That should not get out of this room because the press would find out and they would turn it into a bad thing. We would be bad guys because we had that. That was typical. Our feeling was that the Caravelle Commandos spent a great deal of time at the bar in the Caravelle,
mm-hmm.
And they would tell each other stories, and when the booze would flow, I think I mentioned you could buy a fifth of just about anything you wanted for $1.25, $1.25 for 23 shots. When the booze began to flow and the stories began to get good, afterwards they would each go and write their story for the day based on the tale they had heard from the guy next to him at the bar, and the guy next to him at the bar was writing his story based on what he had heard from the guy who was writing this story.
Mm-hmm.
We did not hold them in high esteem.
Did you have analysts working on what was being reported in the States, or did you just get a general sense of what they were typing up and sending back?
We did not have anyone watching what they were sending or anything like that. We got everything we got directly from the rags that they were writing for.
Okay. And would you have subscriptions like the New York Times and Time and Newsweek and all that and get copies over there?
Newsweek and Time and U.S. News were all over the desks over there.
Okay.
So I don't honestly remember whether we had subscriptions to specific newspapers or not, but we were reading the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes we would try part of my briefing every morning was to look for whatever hot potato might have been in a headline that morning, so that when Westy got it, why, we would already have it answered or explained or whatever.
You would have something.
Try not to let him have it. We didn't want him to be surprised.
Okay.
When he would get the news from the U.S. press corps, we wanted to say, this is what really happened, or that didn't happen, or this is an exaggeration, or some kind of an explanation, so that he would be in a position then to understand how to deal with that when he met with the people he was going to be meeting with all day.
What about non-print correspondence? What about the guys who are actually with cameras and doing reports in country?
Right. Well, I have already mentioned Westinghouse Broadcast,
mm-hmm.
and that was one of those TV reporters whose first question was, did you kill any women or children in that operation, Major? So they were all sort of lumped in with the press,
mm-hmm.
against America, kind of a thing.
I mean, it's very interesting that these lines were laid down, to your mind, at, you know, as early as, what, the summer even of 1965, if not...
No. Right?
Wow.
Exactly.
Because I think, in general, most analysts...
are going to say they didn't turn against the war until 19... Well, that's baloney.
Yeah, they're thinking a little bit later.
Right.
Need to go back and reread that stuff then.
Exactly.
And
right.
Look at it. Mm-hmm.
We read their stuff when it was written.
Right.
And it was negative. As I've said this 1,000 times, if it's bad news, you're going to get an uplink and a byline. If it's really, really bad news, you're going to get a full 2 minutes on the uplink. And if it is horrendous and can make the United States look bad, you might be in line for a Pulitzer. And that's the way it was.
You know, it's interesting when you were talking about and reprising the story about the new napalm.
Right.
Delivery system or whatever those are, a more effective napalm agent and its introduction.
Stickier and hotter.
Stickier and hotter. Yeah, both of which are, you know, great if you're on the delivery side.
That's right.
Our forces just in the last 2 days have been, there have been reports in the press about their use of white phosphorus in the battle for Fallujah.
Uh-huh.
And the same kind of inference is intended to be drawn, I think, that we're doing something, that U.S. troops are doing something really outside the pale.
But these
were standard weapons that were in use in Vietnam era.
Thank God, we used white phosphorus in Korea. We used white phosphorus in the Second World War.
I'm thinking
it was called Willie Peter.
Willie Peter. Yeah.
As an old artilleryman, I can tell you that Willie Peter was pretty doggone good stuff.
Yeah.
because you're fighting people who are trying to kill you, and that's what you do, I would imagine.
Right. Well, that's what one would think in Fallujah, yeah, as well as any of these earlier examples. But again, it's as you started off saying, some things never change.
Right.
Let me ask a little bit about our allies, if you don't mind. Did MACV host visitors from governments who either were considering or had already committed forces in Vietnam? For example, you mentioned a little bit about the tough negotiations on getting South Korea,
right,
to present troops in the Vietnam theater, but obviously we also had other allies who had been active there earlier.
I gave briefings to Australian senior officers. I gave briefing to British senior officers. And those are the two that I remember. I honestly cannot say that I remember giving briefings to other people. I don't know. We had this interesting International Control Commission, or something like ICC.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And the Poles, the Polish were part of it, and the Canadians were part of it. We had two good guys and two of the other guys on the commission.
Right.
I never had anything to do with that. They never appeared at our headquarters, and they were never invited into any of the kinds of intelligence stuff that I was involved in. So I don't know how they worked out. But the people I do remember coming on board to get intelligence briefings were the Australians and the British.
Mm-hmm.
And I dearly love the Australians. They were just fantastic soldiers. They were really something special. They reminded me of Americans from perhaps the 1880s out west or something like that.
Why was that?
They were just more basic. They did not have an accretion of sophistication, so to speak. They were really there to fight a war and have a little fun while doing it if they could. And I just thought they were great. They were really, really fun.
Mm-hmm. Just to reiterate, Tom, you did not get out of Saigon other than on just a few isolated occasions. Is that accurate?
I got out of Saigon one time, and that was an R&R. I guess I'd been there 6 months, mm-hmm, something like that. And by then, as I mentioned, my routine, up at 4 and in by 4:30, 4:40, collect the data, write the script, do the rehearsal, then do the rehearsal again for McChristian if he were available, and then do the real thing for Westy, and then off to give another briefing to some visiting officers, and then write the reports to send off. And it got hectic after a while, and so I was told I could have 5 days, and we had a choice of where we could go,
mm-hmm,
and I chose to go to Thailand because, number one, we could get there faster and have more time off the plane. You could also go to Australia, but you spent a full day going and a full day coming back, and your 5 days was reduced to effectively about 2.5, and so I decided I would go to Thailand. I was going to go with my roommate, who by now became the aide to Lieutenant General Henkes. Did I mention? I mentioned Ken Acousti died of the that virus that attacked his heart sac and
mm-hmm,
so on, and that he had been my roommate in the States when we were in the advanced course. He was a good friend, and when he came over, I met him in that officer's briefing that I did. I didn't have much time to talk to him. He was going out to a rough puff outfit, and within a month he had been in a grenade attack and wounded and was in the hospital. And at this time, General Heinkes was looking for an aide, and I knew Ken would be the perfect aide, and so forth. And so then Ken got to be his aide and moved in as my roommate in the Lakewood Don Hotel. And we worked with another guy named Mac. And Mac's full name doesn't come to me at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
But the three of us decided we would go to Thailand. We're going to go to Bangkok. And the orders were cut, and the day before we were going to leave, Ken came in kind of hangdog and said, General Heinkes has to go to Hong Kong, and he wants me to go with him, so I can't go with you, so just the two of you will go. And so I had arranged with someone in the J2 who knew someone in the Army attaché office down in Thailand in Bangkok to get us reservations in the Rama Hilton Hotel. So we flew down, and the two of us arrived, and we went in to the front desk and said, hi, Major Shepherd, and, oh, Christian, Major Chris Christian here. We have reservations. And the desk clerk says, you don't have reservations. Let me look again. And he looked through this Rolodex kind of a thing. So sorry, there are no reservations. And, well, I did a demonstration in place. I was really upset. I was tired, and I wanted to get a room, and I wanted to relax. And so I was letting off a little steam,
mm-hmm.
and the manager appeared almost in a puff of smoke right alongside, and he said something like, can I help you, gentlemen? And I said, you know, I was telling him, I said, listen, there were three of us, and we have reservations. There were three of us. And I said, one, my friend got shot down in flames, but the two of us are here, and we want our room. And his face changed, and he said, oh, something like, war is so terrible, sir. I am so sorry you've lost your friend. Give these gentlemen a suite. And so we got a suite of rooms, and I realized that his command of English did not include the colloquialism, my friend got shot down in flames. He thought it was literal. And so we had a room. Two rooms, a suite, and that's how we spent our 5 days in the Rama Hilton Hotel in Bangkok because of that miscommunication in English. I thought that was...
So you had the empathy upgrade. Or something.
I think we got the sympathy upgrade, and I never did explain to him. I'm sure when we walked through the lobby, many times we would be smiling and laughing as we came in. I'm sure he wondered, my God,
yeah.
They forget their friend pretty damn quickly.
Yeah, poor guy.
But that was the only break. Then I went back, and at this time, Westy started taking little side breaks because Kitsy, his wife, moved to Hawaii. And then later she moved to another country. And I don't know whether it was Singapore or where, but she moved closer so that Westy could take a 5-day break every once in a while. You know, he was over there for, what, 4 years?
Or right.
5 years, something like that. So he took his first break that I remember when Kitsy was back in Hawaii, and he went back. So they arranged a meeting for him to give briefings to somebody back there. And so he got a little R&R, too. And he played tennis just about as many days as he could at the Cirque Sportif, and I went to the Cirque Sportif as often as I could because, as I mentioned, that saved my sanity.
Mm.
Just get totally away from the hurly-burly of the desk officers and the papers and phone ringing and time limits and all of that stuff.
Well, speaking of that, Tom, when you came back from your own R&R, did you find it more difficult?
Yeah, it's the old story. Work goes on. Work piles up. Things happen. And being a week out of date there felt like being a month out of date in an office in the States. You had to land running in order to catch up because so much had happened. Maybe we... General McChrystian set up a documentation center where they would gather all the documents.
Was it CDEC or...?
Yeah, I believe that's what it was called, the Combined Intelligence Documentation Center. He also set up a Combined Intelligence Interrogation Center. When he first got there, the Vietnamese were not really included in much of the intelligence that we were starting to get, and he wanted to integrate that. And so, in fact, he did do that, and we began then to get diaries, letters that were in people's pockets when we found them, photographs, and all of the little things that give you clues as to what's happening in the enemy side of the ledger, you know, the small stuff that when all added together gives you a better picture of something.
Right, right.
And so we were beginning to get stuff like that, and our intelligence was improving. We were getting more aircraft with cameras, and the Air Force was more coordinated with us. I mentioned we had a four-star Air Force general whose name escapes me, who I thought worked very well with Westmoreland. I thought they had an understanding that was really quite good. So yes, when you've been away 5 days, things marched on, and you wanted to feel that you were on top of everything. You wanted to be the font of all knowledge when you were the briefer for your particular staff section.
Oh, sure.
You wanted to know everything.
Yeah.
And so consequently, then you had to jump in and stay later and get there earlier to find that you were up to speed again. It was amazing how fast things changed over there.
When you look back on it, was it useful for you as the head of the briefing section to have had the training that you had at the Defense Intelligence School?
Oh, absolutely. One of the main reasons was I did not suffer from the imposter syndrome because I felt I had been prepared for the job.
Mm-hmm.
I was in one of the first classes, they called it the DIC, the Defense Intelligence Course. I was in one of the first classes of the DIC. I felt that I had been really trained and that I had been carefully selected because I could do the job. So consequently, just that feeling alone was helpful to arrive and realize that I'm prepared for this kind of a thing. And then, of course, the information that we actually got during the 10 months was very, very helpful. And I think the school paid off.
Yeah, and it sounds, Tom, like you're also crediting General McChrystian with not only kind of turning around a shop that wasn't functioning, but also setting up new institutions within it, like CDEC and the Joint Interrogation Center.
Right. And another thing, I remember McChrystian wanted Westmoreland to be the sole, McChrystian wanted Westmoreland, MACV that is, to be the sole arbiter of intelligence. And he tried mightily to get the CIA to report to Westmoreland's J2. Now, you could say, well, that's a turf thing. But on the other hand, if you understand that doing intelligence operations in an area and you have two competing agencies not necessarily keeping each other informed, you have the opportunity to make a lot of faux pas. And I'm sure that a lot of that went on. And And McChristian tried mightily to get Westy to push hard enough to make the CIA responsive to him, but it never happened. We always knew during the time I was there that they were doing their thing, that they had more money. I mentioned my friend who was the contract agent. Well, he's dead now, so what the hell? It was J. Fletcher Chase. And Fletch had been a contract guy on and off for the agency since the end of the Second World War. He did some fantastic things in France vis-a-vis Cuba, keeping Cuba from getting a certain kind of rail equipment and engines and so on. The FDECE were after Chase. He could not go to France anymore. He worked out of Italy for a while doing things. He had some operations in Africa. Patrice Lumumba and a few of the other dictators found themselves of interest to J. Fletcher Chase. And I mentioned that he took a civilian job as the head of the Mideast Oil Works for Getty Oil. And he spoke affectionately of the old man. And he and Getty had a personal relationship. And he's the one who got Getty's grandson back from the kidnapper in Italy and so on. Well, Chase was over there, and he reported directly to the ambassador. Now, I know that was under the aegis of the CIA, but he reported to Lodge, not to Westy. He had nothing to do with the J-2. And the only reason that we got involved was that he and I developed a personal relationship and really hit it off, enough to stay friends for 30 years, and really hit it off, and I would get tidbits of stuff that he had been working on that I could use in my briefings, but I had no, how shall I say, I couldn't turn and say that, well, we got this from the CIA because that would get him in a world of hurt, and and I don't even know if General McChristian would like to, that would just remind him that the CIA was working on its own over there, and so that fractionalization was not not the best thing. But at the same time, I can understand in human behavior terms the turf battle between the top level people at the CIA and the J-2. Neither one was going to give an inch if they could help it, and they both wanted everything. I worked with the CIA again when I was in the Atlantic Command. We had a resident factotum of the CIA at the Atlantic Command, just as we had a chap from NSA there. And once again, I mentioned I was head of intelligence collection for the J-2 for Sink Lant Fleet, Sink Sac Lant. That's why we were joint and combined. We had all services plus NATO. And oftentimes, the CIA, I found the CIA would come and he would say, in essence, what can you give me? What can you give me? What can you give me? And then we would turn around once and say, what can you give me? And they would, he would say, oh, I'm sorry, you know, I can't see. One time, I gave him a classified document that I had written for him to take back to Washington for his people and so forth. Later on, I asked him for the document back, and he told me he couldn't give it to me. It had been reclassified, and I was...
You weren't clear.
I wasn't allowed to read it.
You weren't clear to see your own document.
I thought that is the height of what we call it, silo operations. You just have your own little world, and you don't let anyone in it. So that was one of the things that Joe McChristian was trying to overcome.
Mm-hmm.
And if I remember, it was never overcome while I was there. And I have a great doubt that it's ever been overcome at all.
Did J2 see any CIA product?
Yes.
Okay.
We did.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But we don't know how much we saw, and we don't know...
Or even rather whether it was real, probably. I mean, when you get to this point.
Yeah. My friend Fletcher Chase, he would often... His cover was that he was working for a major oil company, and he was looking for drilling rights, which would be available after the war was over. And he would be dangling that kind of a thought before a lot of people on both sides. The idea that, well, when this is over, you know, if you're working with us, we will purchase drilling rights from you, and you can't produce the oil because you don't have the know-how,
mm-hmm.
but we will, and you will really benefit. That could be a powerful incentive to a lot of people, as we know from the oil for food scandal.
Sure.
And so that was his dangle,
mm-hmm.
and he had contact with some very interesting people on both sides. Which brings me to the fact that one of the reasons that the Cirque Sportif was a really nice place was it was never on any of the lists that we got from anyone as to a target for the VC sappers. You remember they blew up the Brink Hotel, the Army officers.
Yes.
Billet in Saigon about 6 months before I got there.
Mm-hmm.
They drove a vehicle underneath the thing and blew it up. They blew up the Mykon Hotel. But we always found that the Cirque Sportif was not on it. And we always believed that was because a number of the Vietnamese who belonged had some kind of a relationship with the VC, and they certainly wouldn't want to hurt their own people. And Chase sort of reinforced that. In all of his travels with everyone, he was up in Hong Kong working on this, and he was everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
His information also said that the safe place, because of that relationship with the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese and so on, was the Cirque Sportif. And in the dry season, they set up part of the restaurant on a porte cochere on the roof of the porte cochere that came over the driveway to the club,
mm-hmm.
because in rainy season, my God, it rains, and so the vehicles could pull under that and you could get off without getting wet and so on. In the dry season, they would actually set up part of their restaurant on the patio, which they made on the roof of that. And we would be out having dinner thinking, you know, if we didn't feel really sure, we wouldn't be out here, because what a temptation to drive a vehicle under there full of explosives and blow all the diners to hell
very easily. Yeah,
but,
very easily.
Uh-huh. But we felt that they wouldn't do that because of those reasons, and consequently, that's why we were there.
And it seemed it was too useful for them.
Yeah. They got as much out of it as they possibly could, and therefore they wouldn't hurt it. Although, for myself, whenever I would go out for a cup of coffee on Tudor Street,
mm-hmm.
There was one place called La Pagode,
mm-hmm.
Which was a very nice, well-appointed coffee shop kind of a thing. And I must admit, every time I went in there to look for a table, they had planters, these high planters with flowers and stuff in them, and they were made out of some kind of a shiny material. I would always think, if a grenade comes this way, I will dive behind that one, and if a grenade comes the other way, I will dive behind that one. And then I would order my cup of coffee and feel more at ease.
You would have a plan.
I would have a plan.
And did you have that most of the time that you were in walking around in Saigon?
Did I mention that I lost 22 pounds the first month I was there?
I don't know if you did.
Well, I did.
From upset?
I went from about 185 down to 163, I think it was. And I know that because I could weigh myself when I was a guest at the Cirque.
Uh-huh, right.
In about 30 days, I had lost that. And it wasn't for any other reason than tension.
Wow.
There was just a lot going on.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, let me ask, Tom, over the time that you were in Saigon, and these are the months of early U.S. ground force deployment and major buildup, and as well as bombing, how did, if you can describe it, the mood change in MACV, or the pace change in MACV, or did it?
Yes, it began to change the minute large units of American forces began to land.
Which is pretty soon after you arrived, really.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It was palpable.
Okay.
When I got there, we were still in the, you're in an advisory role. This staff is to advise the South Vietnamese army and so forth. And the minute our troops started to roll in, it became, we're in this, we're fighting the war, we're here to support the American troops coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And remember the Marines came in, and then the Army, and an interesting little thing talking about internecine warfare or turf battles or so on. General Walt, as I remember, Lieutenant General Walt at the time, was a senior Marine commander, and he had his headquarters up north of Saigon, and Lieutenant General Hankus, with my friend Ken Acousti in tow as his aide, was going up on some kind of a fact-finding or going up to deliver something from Westmoreland or so on.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, this is all coordinated. I mean, when the deputy commander, Lieutenant General Hankus, is going up to speak for Westmoreland to the senior Marine, I mean, that's all laid on.
Oh, yeah.
The interesting thing was, when Hankus landed, General Walt had just taken off in his plane to go on a fact-finding tour of some Marine outfits and wouldn't be back until, in parentheses, you're out of here, close parentheses.
Until I hear that you've left.
Right, he wouldn't meet him.
Was the headquarters at Da Nang or for the Marines? Do you know?
I'm not going to jump in on that. I think it was, but I don't have a sure.
Yeah, I don't either.
I can't say for sure.
Yeah, I don't either.
Cannot say.
But anyway, the general. Didn't...
So Hankus hung around just long enough to become embarrassed and then infuriated.
I'll bet.
Then flew back.
I'll bet.
To tell Westmoreland that Walt won't see me and he's gone and so forth. So those little picadillos were going on in our own forces.
Mm-hmm.
Naturally, that didn't happen when American forces arrived. It was the way it was supposed to be because they were our own people, kind of a thing.
And so, what about relations with the South Vietnamese military? Did they change much over the time that you were there?
You know, I did not. I only had hearsay on that. Officers who would drop by that I knew for a cup of coffee,
right,
who were working with the South Vietnamese. I would hear scuttlebutt. I would hear stories, and the prevailing feeling was, we can't trust them.
Mm-hmm.
We were wondering, gee, did that mortar attack happen so accurately because somebody in here was pacing off the distances to the command post, or were they just that lucky, or, you know, those kinds of feelings. When Ken Acousti got caught with the grenade and hit with the fragments and so on, his question was, did those guys really sneak up on us, or were they let in by people in the unit. He was with the he was an advisor, you know, a couple of Americans with the South Vietnamese outfit.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he was with Rough Puff, I think. But that was one of the questions. How come they got there at this exact moment and were able to get inside? Were our guys so ill-trained that they didn't put out sentries and listening posts and fell asleep, or were the other guys let in? Those kinds of things were constantly going. And, of course, we knew from the political people, from the Just Pal folks who would come out to talk to us, we know that the politics, the South Vietnamese politics, were really sticky. They really were factionalized. And you remember that's when the monks started to burn themselves. That made a hell of a splash. What a great photo op for an American journalist to have a guy sit there and set himself on fire after pouring 5 gallons of gas on him.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's a matter of record that in many cases these Buddhist activists would let American journalists, photojournalists.
No, in advance.
Sure, yeah.
Sure, they would say, take him down here.
It wasn't just that they happened to be on the right street corner at the
right
time, yeah.
And
yeah.
one of the quips or bon mots was something about what can burn 5 gallons of gas, go up and down, but not go anywhere. And the answer was something like a Buddhist priest or something like that. There were a lot of factions and a lot of infighting, and the Catholics, the mm-hmm. Vietnamese Catholics, had a hold of a lot of the power, and Bao Dai, and all of these things were going on right underneath us, and so it was a very sticky political situation.
And Tom, sort of going out from there, as you were internalizing and trying to synthesize the new data that was coming in, and over the months you were making these presentations, what, if you can say, was the primary area of military concern for the U.S., let's say by the time you were well in stride, you know, after you'd been there 5, 6 months, 7 months, something like that, was the primary concern the Saigon area and north and west of there, the Parrot's Peak, or would you say it was the Central Highlands or the DMZ area up in I Corps? What was seen as the central problem, or was there no such distinction?
Well, let's see if I can work through that. You remember my belief, and I've heard Westy say it, that this was a big unit war.
Yes.
That they, the bad guys, were bringing in large units,
mm-hmm.
and it was going to be our job to find them and then to fix them and then to finish them off. We worried about the Delta. The Central Saigon area was not the primary concern. That we felt was pretty secure. We were worrying about I Corps. We were worrying about them cutting the peninsula in half. We didn't want to make the mistakes that the French had made. And I feel that what we were trying to do was to find the big units and get rid of them, to fix them and finish them. That was the idea. And we were also looking, we knew that big units had to have a tail, so we were looking for their supply trains. We were looking for their caches of ammo and food. We had no, you remember the tunneling that they did?
Mm-hmm, sure.
We knew that there were tunnels, but we, while I was there, had no idea of the extent that they had tunneled and were tunneling. That was totally foreign to our concept, that they could actually live underground and have a hospital underground and stay underground for days at a time. That, well, the 12 months I was there, 13 mm-hmm. months, that was just beginning to dawn on us that they had a capability that they were using that we really hadn't understood.
That's a little frightening.
They were fighting. That was the thing that always concerned me. Mm-hmm. Their guys could do things like that. Our guys were fighting over turf. Why weren't their guys fighting over turf? Because they would eliminate anybody who didn't comply. We, because of our democratic roots and so forth, always enter a battle with one hand tied behind our back and a blindfold over both eyes, because that's the American way, and it isn't going to change that I can see. And they didn't have that problem. So our guys always needed help. Our guys always felt they could, our Vietnamese always felt they could fall back and call for our assistance, and they could. Mm-hmm. And then after a while, they didn't even have to do that. We just stepped up and started trying to find the big units and fight them and win the war. And that's where the vacillation from the White House came into play, where they wouldn't let us pick the targets, and they wouldn't let us do certain things like when we knew an enemy staging area was just on the other side of that border, we couldn't go over and get it, whereas we knew damn well it was there and we could go get it. And you remember the insane response when we decided that we were going to bomb in Cambodia, in Laos. The American anti-war movement just went bananas over here. The poor president, what the hell is his name?
Just Nixon. Ran,
Richard mm-hmm. Nixon. Mm-hmm. Poor Nixon took a tremendous beating over the fact that he had wised up and decided we were going to bomb Hanoi and we were going to bomb the enemy.
Send troops into Cambodia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That was supposed to be a sin compared the way the left was looking at it. And the correct way to look at it was that's the way you fight a war. You take care of the enemy and destroy him.
Why do you think President Johnson, does this go back to imposter syndrome or is there more to it? Why do you think President Johnson never allowed the kind of U.S. military incursion into Cambodia that Nixon ordered in 1970?
Right, and why did he refuse to let the B-52s or let Rolling Thunder take out mm-hmm. the real targets until mm-hmm. they had been built up? Why did he do that? Because he dithered. He was constantly worrying about how will this affect me politically here in the Senate. What will the senators think of me? What will the press corps think of me? What will the Washington Post think of me? That was his concern.
Wow.
You know, he spent his time getting elected. Had some strange election results, too, when he was first going to Congress. Some really strange ones. I've had dinner in some very, very nice restaurants in Texas mm-hmm. Back 30 years ago, hearing people chat about the really strange things that Lyndon was doing to get elected. you just roll your eyes. And I don't think he never became a statesman. He was a politician the whole time. And I think that was it.
Okay, well, let's take a break there, Tom. This is Laura Calkins of the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, continuing the oral history interview with Dr. Thomas Shepherd. Today is the 13th of December, 2005. I am in Lubbock, and Dr. Shepherd is speaking by phone from Washington State. Tom, thanks very much again for your time and for your participation. Last time, we were recapping some of your experiences in Vietnam, and we talked at some length about the development of General McChristian's career after the time in which you worked with him in Vietnam. And you have some additional observations, I think, that you'd like to pop in here.
Right. That's right, Laura. As I was saying, General McChristian left Vietnam as a major general. He had been, he was the J-2 for General Westmoreland, and he took command of an armored division in Texas. And then when General Westmoreland was made the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he requested that Joe McChristian join him as the ACSI, the Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence. And General McChristian left Texas and went to Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it was interesting to note to me that this was the time when there was a great deal of turbulence in our society. The fabric was actually being rent by the dissenters in the Vietnam War, and a number of really nasty things were taking place. And so it was decided by someone that the Army, which had a number of intelligence operatives in the ACSI, would in fact begin to track some of these people who were planning the attacks on the Pentagon and trying to kidnap Henry Kissinger and making bombs in their townhouses in New York and so on.
Mm-hmm.
When that was discovered by the public and by the newspapers, of course, there was a great hue and cry about that happening. And
about the surveillance by the Army.
Right, the
yes.
surveillance mm-hmm. by the Army of American citizens.
At home.
At home,
mm-hmm.
right.
Mm-hmm.
And Congress got involved. The Senate then had a select committee that was put together to investigate this. And the final report of the select committee to study government operations and intelligence activities by the U.S. Senate decided that the rights of American citizens had been violated by this improper surveillance activities of the Army, and the DOD, the Department of Defense, ended that kind of surveillance in 1971. The scapegoat was General McChristian. He retired precipitously in 1971. And as I mentioned much earlier, he had grand hopes of a wonderful Army career that would be more in tune with his father-in-law, and he was hoping to make 4 stars.
Mm-hmm.
So he was forced out, and I think that left a very bitter taste in his mouth. And then later when the television company NBC or CBS, I guess it was CBS, had a piece that said that Westmoreland had cooked the books, in other words, had not reported the correct numbers to the president about the size of enemy activity in Vietnam.
Definitely and, CBS, yeah.
Right, it was CBS, mm-hmm. and Westmoreland decided he would sue them, and the trial started, and General McChristian was called as one of the key witnesses, since he, in fact, was the keeper of the numbers. He made the point that he had indeed reported higher numbers based on his new appreciation of these irregular forces, and that as he understood it, General Westmoreland did not directly forward those higher numbers to the Department of Defense and to the President and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So in essence, instead of really helping General Westmoreland, General McChristian's testimony, in fact, sort of damned him with faint praise.
Mm-hmm.
And so after that happened, then Westmoreland and CBS decided to mutually drop the suit, and both would make statements saying that, in essence, there were some mistakes made, and they were sorry, and they didn't mean any harm, and that was it. And essentially, Westmoreland lost faith, and essentially CBS looked as if they had been after him in sort of a vendetta.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this then ties right into an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal written by Louis Free, who was the former director of the FBI, and this is dated Thursday, November 17th, 2005, in the Wall Street Journal, and he says, talking about an Army intelligence unit called Able Danger, and Able Danger had said through one of their officers that they, Abel Danger, in fact, had discovered Mohammed Atta in the United States in a year, I believe it was, a year earlier than the flight that he flew into the World Trade Center as the head of the group that attacked the United States with those airplanes. So in this op-ed piece, here is a quote. It says, these same officials also stated that, here's the quote, documents and electronic files created by the Army's Abel Danger were destroyed under standing orders that limit the military's use of intelligence gathered about people in the United States. And that, of course, reflects right back to the final report of the Select Committee of the U.S. Senate, dated 1971, that said it was improper to surveil, for the Army to surveil American citizens. And once again, as far as I can see, that just shows some of the weakness in the arrangements that we have for the security of our country.
Actually, it goes even a little bit farther. See if you'll agree with me, Tom, that in this case, Mr. Atta was not a U.S. citizen, but he was in the United States for a prolonged period of time before the attack, and it looks like the Army had identified him as a potential problem.
Right.
He was not a U.S. citizen, but he was in the United States,
right.
And that's probably why they were able to keep track of him at all, was because he wasn't a citizen. So Abel Danger was doing something, it sounds like, well within the parameters that were open to it.
But the key was they were not allowed to give any of this information to the FBI because of this sort of Chinese wall that someone had decided would be between one intelligence agency and a police agency, and that was designed to protect the privacy of people living here in our country, et cetera, et cetera.
And as a scholar, Tom, I know that it would probably turn your stomach a little bit that the documents have been destroyed.
Oh, yes.
Because there's nothing for us as scholars, students of the military, or as citizens to fall back on,
right,
to actually evaluate what was happened and what mistakes were made, including the failure, obviously, of one federal agency to speak with another.
Right. And all we have then is the Army's Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Schaefer, who was a veteran intelligence officer's recollections about what Abel Danger had found and who he had spoken to about Mohammed Atta and the group he was associated with and so on, is now simply someone's verbal recollection.
Well, verbal recollections are okay, but certainly we know that they have limits. But I think you've done a great job of recasting your own career for us in these interviews, and it's extraordinarily helpful because it does give an extra dimension to documents that do survive, and also takes us in areas where there is essentially no documentation.
Mm-hmm.
And so, it's an interesting interplay between types of evidence, but as you point out, the Wall Street Journal article by Louis Free is one that we should have greater attention to.
Right.
And quite honestly, I had not seen anything by Louis Free outside of his testimony to the 9/11 Commission.
Well, he has just written a book called My FBI, and I believe St. Martin's Press published it this year.
Uh-huh.
So,
have you had a look at it yet?
I have not had a look at it yet.
Uh-huh.
I'm still reading Nelson and Trafalgar at this moment.
Very good.
But I'm sure I'll get there before too long.
Okay. Well, that's it's well worth noting. Tom, are there additional observations that you might like to make about your time in Vietnam? I have one or two questions I'd still like to ask, but I wonder if you had anything else.
The
in
only
your
other
mind.
Thing that pops up that I'm thinking about is the Phoenix program,
mm-hmm.
which was a clandestine program to try and debilitate the infrastructure that the VC had in South Vietnam. And I had lunch with one of the operatives in the Phoenix program one day, and we chatted, and in essence, he was a police officer from somewhere in the Midwest who had signed a contract to come over and help train these Phoenix units in what I would call police procedures of gathering information and trying to determine who was involved in these various, what I call them, networks, mm-hmm. Just as if we were watching street gangs in L.A., he was trying to help the South Vietnamese police look into how to track the ZC gangs and find their locations and sort of do a sociogram to see who was communicating with whom and who got the most messages and who physically saw one person and then another person and so on and so forth. And the ultimate thing, of course, was after you had determined who the key players were, you eliminated them in a variety of ways. You kidnapped them, or you simply arrested them, or you assassinated them. And he was working in the Phoenix program and was telling me some of the nuts and bolts about it and seemed to be, rather upbeat that they were, in fact, being able to track some of the VC networks and were, in fact, lessening their ability to do harm to the government, because on their side, they were very busy assassinating anyone who was a mayor or anyone who was any kind of a civilian factotum of the government. They were just simply knocking them off,
mm-hmm.
and it made it difficult to get new people to want to step into that job. And so they were doing they were doing exactly what the Phoenix program was designed to prevent. And in the prevention, occasionally some of the VC were assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't think that was any terrible thing. However, when it hit the press, of course, later on it came out as assassination squads and all of the horrendous Hollywood-style tripe that our press put out about how bad we were and so forth and so on. So
when did this lunch take place? During your tour there? 65,
oh, yeah.
66?
The Phoenix program was going on while I was there in 1965, 1966. And after I left, I don't know whether it continued on or not. My old commanding officer from Panama, Lieutenant Colonel Wendy Knowles, retired, and the last I had track of him was in the late 60s, and he had gone into Vietnam and joined something called CORDS, C-O-R-D-S, which was an acronym for another kind of a civilian program that we had instituted, and I honestly don't know any more about it right now,
mm-hmm.
than CORDS, and if Wendy Knowles was in it, I know it had some kind of an action capability, because that's the kind of a guy he was. And that was the other thing. That was after I had left, so I don't know much about CORDS.
Okay. But it's your sense that the police...
The Phoenix program?
Yeah, the police system in South Vietnam was already being advised by the United States on how to make better identification of these essentially
yes.
secret cells of VC
right.
activists
right.
During the time you were there.
Right.
Okay. Tom, let me ask you a little bit about this same kind of area of business. You know, when we were talking about your training at the Defense Intelligence School, later DIU, you said that one of the things that really struck you was your awareness upon attending the classes there of this entire kind of world of espionage that was certainly going on in the Washington, D.C. area and probably every major capital. And, you know, over your time in Saigon, you've explained that you were in a very restricted area for your own safety and also for the safety of the information that you had.
Right.
And I wonder whether you ever felt at the Cercle Sportif or elsewhere that you were actually the target of any kind of efforts to squeeze you, or maybe not something as obvious as that, but to elicit information from you or to watch you. Did you feel like you were the target at any
point? Some anecdotal material. We'll start with my friend Fletcher Chase, who was the CIA contract agent at the very high level. He told me that a number of the people in the CERC who pretended to be planters, you know, the rubber plantations out in the boonies, the planters had lovely homes out there, but they also kept places in Saigon, and that a number of the, quote, planters were, in fact, part of SDECE, which was the French equivalent of our CIA. He also thought that a number of the planters, that's in quotes, wives, were also involved with the SDECE. And interestingly enough, my roommate, Ken Acousti, Ken at that time was a brand new major and was my roommate and had been an old friend from the advanced course and so on. And I told you that Ken had, he was quite attractive to the women and that the Dragon Lady had picked him up, I think, the first time he appeared at the Cirque and so forth. Well, he found another French woman was very attracted to him. Denise was a very lovely, early 30-ish young woman who became very, very attentive to Ken. And since I was Ken's roommate, also was very, very nice to me. And as things developed, she got closer and closer to Ken and closer to me. And she even went to the extreme of, she knew that I loved flan after lunch. And each week she would produce a flan for me that was the size of a large dinner plate and about 3 inches high. And I don't know how difficult it is to make flan.
Pretty hard.
These were awfully wonderful. And all she seemed to want from me was more about Ken, you know, Ken's background, Ken's schooling, Ken's former wife, Ken's children. She just wanted to know more and more and more. She never asked me a single thing that I would take to have significance in a strategic or a tactical sense, other than wanting to know more and more about Ken. And my friend Fletch Chase said, you know, she is with SDECE, too. And so I said, well, that, you know, that's really interesting. She can't get anything out of me because she seems to be so crazy about Ken. I then asked her to help me with my French, and she took it upon herself to tutor me in French. And we got to know each other very, very well. And she never did one single thing that made me think that she wanted something from me. Her English was perfect. It was idiomatic American English, but she was attached to Ken like a limpet. And that was quite hilarious.
Where did she tell you, if she did and if you remember, that she was from? Did she say she was born in Indochina?
No, she said she was born in France, and I'm walking right now over to my bookcase, and I have, she gave me a present when I was getting ready to leave, and it's a book by Jean Lattegui, Les Deux Mirons en Algérie, and she wrote in it in French, talking about me being her copain, friend, and so forth and so on. I don't have much more than that, other than to say a number of the French planters who ostensibly did not speak English all seemed to grow big ears when three or four American officers would be sitting at a table talking to one another, and as maybe a cocktail would flow or whatever, they all seemed to lean over.
I hope the French had something more sophisticated going on too, because this seems a little transparent. But were you clear that this was probably, if not an intelligence operative, then she was probably an informant of some kind? I mean,
I would say that she was well enough educated and trained that if she had been, she was very good. As I say, I don't know what she was asking Ken, and I don't know what Ken was telling her. He just kept telling me, I'm not going to be taking her back to the States and so forth and so on. One other little thing.
Sure.
There was one Frenchman who was absolutely adamant that the Americans were nasty and he didn't want to be around them and so forth. And he made it a point of not leaning over to listen to us. He always kind of kept off to himself. And one day, as I was going to the large swimming pool, which was at the end of the tennis court group, we had a large Olympic-sized pool there where they served lunch. And he was sitting off by himself in a chair near the diving tower. And I was walking by him. There wasn't a single person around him. I was walking by and I looked over at him, and he was scowling at me. He was just giving me the stare, and at that moment, it's hard to describe, but a little black hole appeared right above his left nipple, and he went over backwards, and then I heard the bang. He had been shot, and the thing that I thought of was a sniper. And I hollered out, "Sniper, sniper," and began to run and duck down and get behind some of the architecture there at the edge of the pool. And I don't think the French know what sniper means, but the Americans certainly did. And people looked around and started moving and getting under cover. And we waited. And in the meantime, I wondered, well, is anybody going to help this guy? He's lying out there. Bleeding, and nobody made a quick move to go over there. And then eventually I hollered, "Let's pull him out of there," and we got the guy and dragged him out. And then someone called for an ambulance, and I called I believe I called the COC and said, "Hey, a shot's just been fired over here and a guy's been hit," and so on. Well, it turned out that a white mouse, which, as you know, is the white uniformed Vietnamese policeman. A white mouse was in the woodland park that surrounded the Cirque Sportif, and he saw a squirrel that was running toward a bird's nest. In order to solve this problem for the bird, he fired his pistol at the squirrel. Apparently it hit a branch and was deflected and just sung right through the trees for about 100 yards and hit my poor Frenchman right in the chest. And that was what the sniper was. It was nothing more than that, some stupid act by a guy with a pistol. But it gave us about 20 minutes of real excitement around.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I can believe it.
We were wondering what's going to happen next. I mean, a single shot that's got to be the opening for something, and it was just nothing.
Did the French fellow recover?
As I understood it, he did recover. They whisked him off to the hospital, and he was saved.
That just wasn't his day, though. I mean,
it really wasn't. And it was the first time I ever saw anyone sitting in a bathing suit getting shot. And you actually see a little hole as he falls over. So, anyhow.
Well, just to clarify, the white mice, was that the name that was given?
That was the nickname.
Yes.
Particularly the derisive nickname that we...
Yes, it is a little... It is a little mean, really, but I think that was all intentional, as far as I can tell.
Right.
And was that particularly for MPs, Arvin MPs, or was it for
police? No, they were the civilians.
Civilian police.
They were the police, the civilian police force. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Right, and they were the ones who Captain Archie Kuntzey said would be perfectly fine to protect our hotels and things like that.
That's the mayor of Saigon that you told us about.
That was the mayor of Saigon, right.
Yeah. Tom, let me ask you about your observations on other intelligence agencies, U.S. intelligence agencies that were operating. You've mentioned Fletcher Chase and some other contract people who were in different agencies. And I just wonder whether you were able to sort out any differences or discrepancies between the MACV assessment of the military situation in South Vietnam at any point and during your time there, and any differences between that and what these other agencies were turning up, and what their kind of line was, if you will, on the U.S. war, on the Vietnamese war, on the strategic situation. Were there any discrepancies or differences that you ever identified that, they're saying something or thinking something other than what we in MACV are thinking?
As you remember, McChristian wanted to have all intelligence report through him to Westmoreland.
Yes, right.
So, in essence, he wanted the CIA to come under his wing, and that did not happen.
Right.
And I only heard, felt that the agency was not playing the same game that General McChristian was. The only agency guy that I knew personally was Fletch Chase, and Chase had a complete disdain for the Central Intelligence Agency.
As a bureaucratic institution?
As a bureaucratic institution that was so tied to bureaucratic principles that he felt that they were relatively worthless, and he wouldn't trust any of them. He would not report to middlings if he was going to take a contract. His contract had to be with the highest level that he could negotiate, and it wasn't going to be with some of these so-called case officers that came in and out for a year at a time and so forth. So I personally only knew him as being a CIA contract guy.
Mm-hmm.
I knew his disdain for the bureaucracy of the agency, and I knew that in MACV there was a feeling, which I imagined that it actually emanated from General McChristian, that the CIA was not playing the same ball game that we were. But I have no specifics about that.
Okay. I'm just trying to get to the kind of feeling that you had, that there certainly was more going on than you personally were aware of, but you were at least very clearly aware that there was this other dimension.
There was another dimension.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay. Tom, let me ask about your thinking as you were coming toward the end of your tour in Saigon. Were you anxious to leave, or did you think you might like to stay, or how, what was your thinking about your own career planning at this point?
Uh-huh. Well, two things come to mind right away. There was a young lieutenant colonel named McChrystal, who was on the operations side, and as I heard it, Westy asked him to stay on for a variety of reasons, and McChrystal chose to stay on for another year.
Mm-hmm.
And the last I heard, McChrystal had 2 stars and retired. I think there was some benefit to hanging around for a second tour.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, I think I told you about sitting in the briefing theater with the general officer who was going to do the briefing after me. He was the three, the operations officer, mm-hmm. and he had just come from DesOps, Deputy Chief of Staff for Operations. And while we were sitting there just fiddling, waiting for the grand entrance of the people we were going to brief, we chatted. He was a very nice, easy to talk to fellow, and mm-hmm. we chatted. And he asked me how long my tour was, and I told him it was a year. And I said, I know you have to stay longer than that, General. He said, yes, I'll be staying at the pleasure of General Westmoreland. It could be 2 or 3 or however long he wants me to. And then he sort of lamented. He said, you know, for the last 3 years at Des Per, I worked 6.5 days a week, and I was generally there at 7 in the morning, and I didn't leave until 7 or 8 at night. And so, in essence, I only saw my family on Sunday afternoons for the last 3 years, and here I am here, and I won't see him at all. I could be here for a couple of years and so on. And at that moment, I looked at his collar and saw his silver stars, and I knew that on my collar there was a gold oak leaf, and I wondered at that moment, is this what I want to do? Am I willing to pay this kind of a life mm-hmm. to get those stars? And it was the first little chink in the gung-ho, regular army, airborne, I'm going to make it to the top kind of a feeling. And it was startling. I guess you could say it was an epiphany that the way he sounded and the rewards that he had, the 2 stars or 3 stars, I was beginning to think, gee. And in the meantime, I had 3 little boys at home, and I hadn't seen them in almost a year. And I kind of think I would have really been between Charybdis and Scylla if General Westmoreland had said, Tom, I'd like you to stay for another year. It would be some choice, I'll tell you.
And I was just looking back, Tom, you were about 35 years old.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think that's, right. That sounds about right to me.
I made late colonel when I was 37, and so I was 35, exactly.
Yeah. And that's, I think, the time, especially if you have young children, when you start thinking, have I got everything right?
Right. I had a 1-year-old. He wasn't quite, he was just 1-year-old, and a 4-year-old, and like a 6 or 7-year-old. And I must admit, I was thinking about getting back to see them. So.
And how did it come about that you were posted to Norfolk? Do you remember getting those orders?
I was absolutely, I had to ask, what the hell is this Sink Lamp? I had no idea what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in the J2 shop and went up and said, you know, what is this Sink Lamp? And I was quickly informed, wow, you're being assigned to a joint and combined staff. And I reached back in my memory trying to remember joint meant that it would be Army, Navy, Marines, Air Force. Combined meant that it would be foreign military and the American military. So joint and combined meant it was the whole Megillah. It was all, and I was surprised. And Norfolk sounded nice since I was an East Coast guy and I loved the water and so forth. And everyone seemed to be jumping up and down saying, wow, what an assignment. So I figured, gee, it must be good. That was the extent of what I knew about the Atlantic Command at that particular time.
Well, how did your last week or so in Saigon go, if you remember? Did people throw you a party, or?
It went real fast, and the party was an informal. Your close buddies went out, and you had a couple of bami bas.
And which is what?
Bami ba is 33. It's a beer that was locally produced in Saigon, and the myth was that it was made with embalming fluid. And I found out later that tiny amounts of embalming fluid had been used in a variety of alcoholic drinks throughout the ages. So it wasn't a stupid ha-ha. Mm-hmm. It was, gee, maybe so. And Bami Ba used to give you the most horrific headache the next morning that you could ever imagine. Mm. But there were only two kind of beers, and Bami Ba was one, and the logo was the numeral 33, and it was local. And so a few of your tight buddies go out and have a few drinks, and you pat one another on the back and talk about the good times you had and lament leaving, and that was it. In that kind of situation, they don't bake a cake and come in singing in your office or something like that.
No. There's clearly too much work to be done, especially at this level with the people that you were interacting with. That's clear. Did you have any regrets on leaving?
Here's the one thing I thought of. Uh-huh. By God, I am on the inside. I know. And I know it before some of my bosses know it, because I get to tell them what they're going to know.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a kind of a heady feeling to realize that you were on the inside. You were behind the green door, and you had access to everything. That was pretty nice. And I felt, well... I'm going to another job that I'm going to be chief of intelligence collection for the Atlantic Command. That'll probably be pretty good, too. And so I missed the idea that I would be on the inside of Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
Tom, as
you transitioned to Norfolk and you kind of found your feet there, and I'll ask you about that in a second, did you find yourself... watching very closely what was happening in Vietnam and trying,
I had a little map, and I had some of my buddies' pins stuck on the map, so I knew where Holyoaks would be, and I knew where Bill Burdishaw was and things like that. But after a few months, things were really humming in the Atlantic Command, and it was like, well, my contact with Vietnam then was when I had a major who was worked for me, and he was a Marine major, and he got assigned to Vietnam in 1968. He was over there for Tet.
Mm-hmm.
But that we were worrying about very different things at the Atlantic Command than that. That's when, for the first time, my whole intelligence focus shifted, and the primary thing was Cuba.
Well, Tom, if you can, can you walk us through the organization of the J2 shop at Norfolk and where your collection unit came in the hierarchy and where you sat?
Laura, I must admit I haven't thought of that in a while, but it was relatively standard.
Okay.
We had a four-star admiral. And when I arrived, it was Tom Moorer, M-O-R-R-E-R, who went on to be the chief of naval operations. And he was charismatic. He was a wonderful guy. In the few months that he was there, that I was there, I was really impressed. He had the human touch. He made people feel wanted, and you wanted to give this guy your best. He was really something else. I could see why he had become a four-star and went on to be the chief of naval operations. He was just he just radiated command leadership. It was really nice. So we had a four-star, and we had a three-star. We had a vice admiral. We had an admiral and a vice admiral, mm-hmm. a three-star. And they were Think-Lant, Commander-in-Chief Atlantic Command, and they were also Commander-in-Chief of the Atlantic Fleet, and they were also Commander-in-Chief of SAC-Lant, which was the NATO arm. That's where the combined staff came in.
Okay.
So he was Think-Lant, Think-Lant Fleet, Think-SAC-Lant. And he had the same staff under him. We all worked under those three hats. And the unique thing, well, there were a few unique things. We had a CIA liaison officer embedded with us there.
Mm-hmm.
We had an officer from the NSA. That was Dr. Jerry Ledvina. An interesting guy.
Mm-hmm.
So we had the CIA there, we had the National Security Agency there, and we also had an ambassador in residence, sort of like someone in the State Department who had been an ambassador somewhere, and they wanted a holding tank for him. He would end up at the Think-SAC-Lant as our ambassador in residence, our State Department guy, who was, of course, supposed to give advice to the admiral, as was all the rest of the staff. So then we had the operations, and we had intelligence, and we had submarines was a separate command, and Naval Air was a separate command. And I remember specifically the fun when I first went down to a submarine to give them their SICRs, the SICR, which was Special Intelligence Collection Requirement. These were the top secret above, you know, we had extra notations on them,
mm-hmm.
For the submariners. And the first time I went on board, I thought some of them would fall off the gangplank when I came up because they knew that Think-Lant Fleet Intelligence Collection guy was coming down, and they expected a commander. And instead, they got an Army light colonel. But they were always glad to hear that I knew nautical terminology,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I knew to salute the flag, and I knew what the quarterdeck would be, and I knew the conning tower, and I knew the various naval ranks and things like that. So that was okay, and occasionally I would have lunch on board the submarine while I was delivering the sickers, which the captain would put in his safe and not open until he was at sea.
And what were these, the operational orders or
yes, they were, mm-hmm. very, very classified operational orders.
Okay.
I will say the United States Naval Submarine Force was fighting a Cold War that would have astounded the civilians and also the other armed forces if they knew the extent to which we were pushing the Soviets at that time. Provocation, you bet. There were all kinds of things going on that the Navy could not reveal. Even, you know how you have compartmented intelligence, yes, and one group doesn't know what the other group is doing, and
sure,
so forth. Mm-hmm. Well, believe me, there was a good deal of that. And our submarine force, they were fighting a war just as our infantry guys were fighting over in Vietnam. And it was against the Soviet Union. And they were doing some marvelous, dangerous things in collecting intelligence. So...
Would you say that the provocative maneuvers or whatever were policy? Was provocation policy?
Let me clarify that and say they would have been intensely provocative if they had been discovered.
Got it.
The idea was, let's not let them discover it. Let's not let the Soviet Union discover it.
Okay.
And there's always that chance element that they will. And if they do, is it worth what we're getting to provoke them that strongly?
Is the intelligence harvest, as we now say,
right,
worth it? Okay.
Right. Was it worth it? And there was a school of thought that said, no, it's not. And there was a school of thought that said, yes, it is, just as you might imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And in many instances, the yes, it is carried the day. And our submariners did all kinds of things. Occasionally, I would sit in on some underwater videos that had been shot, and I would just look in amazement at what I was seeing there. Just one quick example that
sure,
I know is okay.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Our submarine running so close to the Soviet submarine, so close behind it, we could watch the propellers cavitate as they turned. They were that close. It was absolutely amazing.
Wow.
And as you may have heard from other sources, they were doing things like tapping underwater cables and entering harbors and taking photographs and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So,
how much, Tom, can you tell me about your work that you did?
I was sitting in what you would consider to be a paperwork operation. I was preparing the sickers based on requests that my office would get from a variety of sources that wanted to know certain things about certain things. And we would put the sicker together and then log it with all of the appropriate agencies and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would hand carry it down to the submarine or whoever was getting that sicker. Mostly it was submarines. A lot of times we ourselves would not be actually privy to why this information was wanted. We would just know that it was wanted, and we were the ones who tied it together to see if we could get it. As I remember, the Atlantic Command was interested in the literal, and I'm talking about LITT, the literal areas that encompassed about 126 nations from the beach inward 50 to 100 miles. That's where we were collecting,
mm-hmm,
the ocean and the littoral. And there were something like 126 nationalities involved. And as you can imagine, many of them were of such little interest to us that they were simply names and numbers. But we were vitally interested in the Caribbean. We really were working hard with Cuba, trying to find a variety of things out. One of the obvious things we were looking for was are there nuclear warheads still in Cuba? And we were trying to work closely with our CIA liaison, and that's when I discovered, or maybe even rediscovered, that the agency was a, how will I put it, a gimme organization. Gimme, gimme, gimme. What have you got for me? Gimme, gimme, gimme. And I actually had the situation arise where my office put together a report for the agency, and we gave it to our rep, who was a nice guy and friendly, and we drank coffee together and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then shortly thereafter, I asked him for his copy of the report back, and he said, I can't give it to you. And in essence, he told me, it's classified. And I said, I know, we classified it. He said, yes, but now we've classified it, and I can't give it to you. So they wouldn't even give us back something that we wrote and gave to them.
Why did you ask him for it back? Can you say?
I believe, and you know, I have to really reach back then, but I believe we wanted to make an addendum, or we wanted to make some kind of a change, because we didn't want this thing out there with
mm-hmm.
what was in it. We wanted to make a change in it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it was CYA, I don't know, but he said you can't have it because it's classified.
You weren't cleared to read what you wrote.
We weren't cleared for whatever he had.
Whatever you had written.
Yeah.
You weren't cleared.
Maybe he did something to it. We don't know. But,
wow.
And that's when I realized that no matter what we asked for, we only got smiles and nods, and yet he was asking for stuff all the time. The ambassador in residence never stuck his nose in the door. He was just simply a nice chap who had an office down the hall somewhere,
mm-hmm.
and occasionally you'd see him. NSA, Dr. Jerry Ledvina, I don't know what his PhD was in, but it was in something, and he had special locks on the door of his office so that nobody could walk in on it.
How do you spell his last name?
Ledvina. I guess, as I remember, it would be L-E-D-V-I-N-A.
And
Ledvina.
You couldn't just drop in on
him. He had special locks on the door.
Right.
And he also had a little peephole that he could look out. And he was a real nice guy, and he and I became quite friendly. And an amusing thing, he had in his office, he had a new Polaroid camera. And one day, as I was walking by, he called me into the office and said, can you help me load this thing? And we were trying to put a film pack in this camera, this Polaroid Land camera. And we had spent 5 minutes trying to push this thing in and pull the flaps. And it suddenly occurred to me, I said, Jerry, between the two of us at this moment, we have 5 university degrees, and we can't load a damn Polaroid camera. So he was a funny guy, an interesting guy. We never seemed to bother him very much, and he never seemed to bother us very much, but he was right there at the Atlantic Command in case some kind of liaison had to be done, and I'm sure he was busy every day, but I don't know busy doing what.
Tom, can you tell me anything about NATO countries who might have had representatives there and whether they were cushioned from some of the intelligence product that you've kind of given us a survey?
Oh, sure. Their offices were down in another wing. The one I remember particularly, a big booming-voiced guy who I believe was Dutch, and he was a naval officer. We had a number of Canadians, but I remember the Dutchman because he thought he had a command of idiomatic English, and he wasn't really in command of his English, and he would pull gaffes during conversations that used to be hilarious sometimes. We had female officers there, and he thought it was quite, what would I say, he thought he was being quite humorous and with it when he would use scatological references to things. Mm-hmm. And it actually would be embarrassing.
Pretty bad.
Mm-hmm. Because he had a voice that was about 100 decibels at lunch or after at the happy hour, and he would be shouting out things to comrades to become rattly, and they would be filled with scatological references, which would turn everyone's ears red, but he thought he was being one of the regular guys.
Mm-hmm.
So we had Canadians, we had this Dutchman. Obviously, there were no French because the French had pulled out.
Right.
And I wish there were because I was dying to try and keep polishing the French I had tried so hard to learn mm-hmm. in Saigon, but there was no opportunity to. So,
was it only NATO
yes.
allies who were involved?
Yes,
okay.
And not a complete representation of mm-hmm. NATO, but we had the NATO allies, as I say, Canadian and Dutch. One of the things they were working on a lot was trying to get standardized things working between our navies. Something as simple as if an American oiler, that's a ship
mm-hmm.
which carries the fuel for warships that are not nuclear, if an American oiler came alongside a Greek destroyer, we might not be able to service that destroyer because the fittings on our hoses and their receptacles would not be standard. So we could have an oiler full of oil and a destroyer that's practically dry, but we couldn't get stuff back and forth. So they were trying to produce standards for a whole variety of naval things that would allow us to work together better. They were also working on tactics and communications so that we would be a more cohesive group. And that was way out of my realm of interest. I only picked this up when we were having lunch and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that having NATO in the officers' mess, it ameliorated the American habit of dining as if it were just a fuel stop so you could get back to your office. In NATO messes, they have wine available for lunch. Navy, as you know, abhors the idea of alcohol on a ship. The Royal Navy has alcohol on a ship. The old grog is held over for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And so we found that, for instance, I would be having lunch with some of the NATO types, and I would look at my watch and say, oh, my God, it's 5 minutes to one. I've got to get back. And they would ask me, but why, old boy? Surely things can wait another 15 minutes. We were just telling you about this and that. And they felt sure that the relationship building was rather important, and it helped gel the organization. And you should slow down a minute and have a glass of wine with them and listen to what they're saying and so forth. And we were based on, by God, I've got to get back to that office, and I've only had 48 minutes here, and I need, and so forth and so on. So
our typical American neuroses.
Yeah.
You know, get it, and get on with the next thing.
Right. These chaps, much more relaxed, and I'm sure their digestion was much better.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was one of the interesting things.
That's very interesting, yeah. The mood is different when Europeans are around, even if it's in Norfolk, Virginia.
Right, exactly. They made sure it was different. They demanded that it be different. They were not going to do that American baloney. And so that was very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's something that came to mind. We were saying we have the operations, and we had the J-2 and so forth, and we had submarines, we had naval air, we had the destroyer squadron, DESRON. I used to love the Navy descriptions of things. Com, DESRON, PAC, DAC, BAC. And they would know what that meant. They were longer acronyms than the Army ever thought of.
That's right.
But we had an information center that was run by a commander whom I won't name.
Mm-hmm.
He's dead now. But his job was to do exactly what I was doing in Vietnam, except he had the whole shebang. He had all of the briefers and all of the analysts working for him, and he was charged with preparing the intelligence briefings and estimates, and he operated as if he were the only unit in Sink Land. The world revolved around his operation, and of course it didn't. So he sparked a lot of problems for various people. And one of the things that he seemed to be really good at was finding a problem, even if he had to sort of help manufacture the problem, and then he would solve it, and then he would go to the J-2, who was a Navy captain named Paul Adams. Paul Adams' family name was actually Adamopoulos. He was a Greek fellow, and he was an academy man, and Paul Adams was quite taken with this commander who found all of these fires that had to be put out, and then he would put them out so Captain Adams would feel secure again. So one day, one of our ships was crossing the Atlantic, and the Russians used to send, we'll call it the Soviets, used to send reconnaissance aircraft occasionally, the Russian Bear, which was a four-engine aircraft, and they also had a two-engine aircraft that they would send down, and they would fly over and photograph and track our aircraft carriers when they would leave Norfolk or May. What is it? May? The next Navy port south. May something. But they would track them sometimes, and they would be provocative. They would fly very low. They would fly right alongside the ship at the level of the ship's conning tower and so forth, and take photos and all of this. Well, one day, one of those Russian twin-engine planes was flying parallel to the course of this carrier, right, just practically alongside of it. Now, if he is parallel with the flight deck, you know he's only 70 feet above the water, and he made a turn. If I forget which side the carrier is on, but he made a turn, and he made it too sharply, too steeply, and his wingtip touched the water, and it catapulted the plane in a cartwheel, and it crashed into the water, and we put boats over the side and picked up a lot of the debris, and one of the things that we picked up was a locked briefcase Now, that was brought back to the Atlantic Command. And remember now, I'm intelligence collection.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this commander, he, being a Navy guy, and it was a Navy command, and there weren't a lot of Army people there, it took me a little while, but I found out that he had gotten hold of the briefcase and had brought the J-2 down and was doing a whole presentation kind of a thing,
mm-hmm.
to which I was excluded because I was not a Navy officer. And so I really raised a little rumpus about this,
yep.
and I found not only that it was true, but that it took the captain to decide that, yes, indeed, I could be privy to the information we were collecting from this briefcase.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was in this commander's office, I found a rubber stamp, which I am walking over to my desk right now and taking out.
No kidding.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Which says, U.S. Navy eyes only. And he was stamping all kinds of things with that damn stamp, which I am holding in my hand at this moment.
How did you get hold of it?
I purloined it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's very possible to pick something up in the midst of a whole bunch of activity going
sure,
on.
Sure, not even notice.
I purloined it and brought it back to my office, and then I stamped a few things with it and took it to the captain and said something to the effect that this won't work. You know, you've got to make changes and so forth. And
mm-hmm.
So then suddenly I became an honorary Navy officer because I was allowed to read all of the stuff that we were collecting and so forth and so on. But talk about inter-service rivalry. I mean, there was a case that was blatant.
In this instance, how high did the friction go? I mean, over your head?
The friction was, as far as I know, pretty much contained within the J-2.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Captain Adams, I had a, well, you remember Neil Carmody?
Yes.
You remember his name anyhow.
Yes.
Neil Carmody once told me that he could work for the devil himself, and he was doing it right now. Because when Captain Adams said good morning, you instantly said, I wonder what he means by that.
Uh-huh.
So he was a very, mm-hmm. He was a Levanter. You catch that one?
I do, but not everybody
the Mediterranean
would.
Literal,
mm-hmm.
he was a Levanter. He was a Greek, and
mm-hmm.
and you never quite knew what he was thinking or meaning, and so that's why Neil said, when he says good morning, you wonder, what does he mean by that? So there was a little intrigue there
mm-hmm.
all of the time
mm-hmm.
in the J-2 section.
Were you the most senior Army person there?
I was the most senior Army person in the J-2.
Right.
The
uh-huh.
most senior Army person was a full colonel who worked over in the J-3. He had a sort of an Army, he had a designation as the senior Army officer. In other words, he was the rabbi I was supposed to go to if I had an Army problem.
I see. Mm-hmm.
And he was a full colonel, and his last name was Kane, K-A-N-E, as I remember.
Now, Tom, just to clarify, you were in this position from 1966, am I right, to when?
As a matter of fact, I can also pull out a document that will help me with that.
Okay, great.
I was there in 1966, and I stayed till the end of 1969.
That's a good solid tour.
Yeah, it was indeed. I got thoroughly involved in the operation. By that time, I knew my Navy pretty damned well. I had been aboard a few more ships on sort of orientation things, and I had a lot of friends in the submarine side, and I had a Marine gunnery sergeant working for me, and I had become a real purple suitor, as we used to say.
Which is a reference to what?
A purple suitor is a reference to somebody who works on a joint staff and has given up being an Army officer or a Navy officer or a Marine officer. He's a purple suitor, which means he has a broader vision than the narrow parochial look of the Army or the Navy or the Marine Corps or the Air Force, that kind of thing.
You know, somebody listening to this part of the interview would not even really be aware that the United States had built up to 500,000 plus men in South Vietnam.
That's right.
How much did the demands of the Vietnam conflict impinge on or affect the naval and other forces that were operated through Norfolk?
Okay, let's see. You know, I'm not sure how I could answer that.
Could the
one thing that I saw in terms of the Navy, for instance, you may remember when the USS Pueblo was captured by the North Koreans and pulled into their port at Haiphong. Am I right? Haiphong?
Haiphong is North Vietnam.
That's wrong war.
Right.
Pulled into the port in North Korea.
Like Hung Nam or somewhere like that?
Yeah, and I can't honestly remember.
That's okay.
Wonderful. Well, do you remember the Pueblo?
I do remember the Pueblo.
Okay.
But maybe you could
refresh your memory a little.
Sure, that'd be great. That'd be helpful.
It was a real clunker of a ship. it was an auxiliary ship.
Yes.
And it was underpowered. And it was seaworthy, but it was on its last legs, and it was crammed with intelligence collection gear for ELINT, electronic intelligence collection, and it was manned by a crew that was sort of a hodgepodge of people, and the intelligence types were practically brand new to the crew, and it was sent out to collect electronic intelligence over in the South China Sea, and it was always to stay in international waters, and it did. And one day the North Koreans sent out a few gunships and pulled it over and took it under tow. And it was the first time a Navy ship had surrendered, and it was a horrible thing for the Navy and so on. And the ship was towed into North Korea, and the crew was held prisoner, and they were interrogated and photographed, and their photographs were put out around the world and so on. And the United States was made to look a weak fool.
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't even protect our own Navy, and the Navy surrendered and so on. Well, at that very same time, the Atlantic Command had the same kind of a vessel, and it was out doing the same kind of thing, only we were running it around the Cuban area, and when we heard that Pueblo had been taken and that nothing had been done about it, aircraft were not launched from aircraft carriers, and a nuke was not dropped on Pyongyang, or nothing was done about it. Why, that sent shockwaves to the Atlantic Command, and we instantly pulled our own vessel back out of harm's way and tried to assess, you know, what the hell is going on here.
Mm-hmm.
The Soviets had these ELINT trawlers right outside of Norfolk. They used to pick us up. The minute we had a ship hit international waters, one of their trawlers was right alongside taking pictures, even getting in the way. They played chicken for a while, where they would get in the way of our ship and try and make our ship change course and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So we were suddenly on the alert that, oh, my God, look, if that happened to the Pueblo and nothing's happened, we better make sure that we're not put in the same position. And so we had to pull our ship out of the area where it was patrolling. And it, in essence, denigrated our Elint collection because of what had happened to the Pueblo. The Pueblo prisoners were held for several months before enough pressure was applied to get them released, and then the captain was court-martialed and so forth. It's, you know, it's another piece of history over there.
Mm-hmm.
But my point is, we were using vessels in those situations that were really creaky. They were unarmed. They weren't. I think they had 50 caliber machine guns as their armament.
So very lightly armed.
It would just be that couldn't do much at all, particularly against three or four gunships.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know why that was happening. Whether it was because we were stretched so thin in terms of our fleet, I don't know. But indeed, that did happen, and it raised a lot of alarms when it took place.
I would imagine that it would, and it sounds too, Tom, from your telling of it, kind of like a sort of kick in the gut too, in terms of morale, because there wasn't a military response.
Right, and when the crew was held, and they were the North Koreans were photographing them for the press and so
mm-hmm.
forth. One of the crew had his hands on the back of a chair, as I remember,
mm-hmm.
and while the photo was being taken, he withdrew three of his fingers and only left the middle finger extended. And so when that photograph hit the world, there was a great guffaw as American types realized, my God, look at that, he's given them the finger. And mm-hmm. later when he was released, he talked about the terrible beatings he got after they figured out that gesture he
mm-hmm.
made had made them look foolish. He suffered a great deal because of that. And we kept thinking, why the hell aren't we doing something for these guys? I mean, wow. And you may not remember, but we had an Elint aircraft that was shot down over international water. And, you know, they're big lumbering aircraft flying along, and up come a couple of MiGs, and they knocked it down. And what are we going to do about that? And the answer was, well, not much at this particular time. So
there were a number of crises.
Yes.
In the late 1960s, there were, for example, I think U.S. nuclear missiles fell off plane in Spain. Yes, that was kind of a disaster.
We had to find them.
Mm-hmm. That was not good. And there were others, but there were also some domestic issues. And I wonder, Tom, just as we close, if I can ask you to think back to 1968 and the domestic political upheaval that occurred that year, particularly following the assassinations of civil rights leader Dr. King and Robert Kennedy, who at that point had was running for president.
Mm-hmm.
President Johnson, of course, as you recall, had declined to seek another term.
Right.
And I wonder if when you were out and about in Norfolk, Virginia, on any of these occasions, do you recall anything different? Any episodes that come to mind where you could tell things were coming a bit undone in the U.S. at this time?
Well, I lived almost a cloistered life down there.
Mm-hmm.
I lived in a nice little part right on the border between Norfolk and the beach area. It had a couple of little lakes in it. There were a number of my friend Neil Carmody lived over on the next street, and we carpooled. I hung around with a lot of naval aviators and who for one reason or another had become involved in the intelligence business.
Mm-hmm.
I carpooled with Neil. We were in working 6 days a week. So we were pretty cloistered. We socialized with our own kind. And it made it easier. You know, when you have a lot of security clearances,
sure. Yeah.
And you're at a cocktail party, you're continually thinking, did I read that in Newsweek Time, or was that in a highly classified document?
Yesterday's briefing from, wherever, whatever other command. Yes, exactly.
So you were much more comfortable with your own kind, where a slip of the lip wouldn't mean the end of the world,
mm-hmm.
and where you had a great deal of mutual experiences. We could all talk about the war and Vietnam and the ships and submarines and what we were doing and what we were trying to find out about Cuba and did they have nukes and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So my interaction with the, quote, civilian community, quote, unquote, was practically nil. I had no opportunity to meet civilians, and I didn't go out and try to mm-hmm. meet civilians. So my feelings were very much in the military community, and right there it happened to be Navy, and I felt as Navy as could be, and I will admit that a number of times when I would see a destroyer at the wharf, I said, by God, I should have gone to Annapolis. That would mm-hmm. be the greatest job in the world, to command that destroyer and so on. And so I don't know. All I understood was the reports, the actual intelligence reports that we got about what was going on out in the civilian world. I remember one individual that was involved up in the Pentagon area. When I was talking to him, he was telling me about the day the crowd tried to march on the Pentagon, and that there were actually people in the mob that had blood caps taped onto their palms, you know, a gelatin capsule filled
mm-hmm.
with blood
mm-hmm.
taped onto the palm, and they would be looking for the television reporters, and as soon as they would spot one, they would simply smack the top of their head and then run out in front of the camera, and this blood would be dripping down their face, and obviously the reporting then would be, look at this, what the police have been doing, and there would be some poor innocent with a blood-covered face and shirt and so on. And hearing tales like that, I just felt it was a pretty bad situation, and I could understand why General McChristian and his guys were trying to surveil these people and find out what they were doing and what the weather underground was really all about and
mm-hmm.
How we could destroy them. I thought that would be a wonderful thing. I wasn't much into the freedom of speech when it came to blood capsules in the palm and townhouses blowing up while the occupants are trying to make bombs. So,
well, and some of those feelings that you've described, Tom, are exactly the feelings that I think then candidate Richard Nixon tried to point to and say there's this great majority in the country who are not involved
mm-hmm.
in these activities, whether real or imagined or faked up, and those are the people who want law and order, and that's the electorate to whom he appealed in 1968. He was extraordinarily successful, as you know.
Right.
Well, Tom, let's take a break there.
Okay.